Yugoslavian war criminal Slobodan Milosevic is dead. In a scene reminiscent of the end of Hermann Göring, Milosevic was found dead in his cell at The Hague on Saturday. No cause of death has been established. The United Nations is investigating. Milosevic was standing trial for crimes against humanity stemming from the bloody Balkan Civil War that followed the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. The butcher from Belgrade, as he was known, was 64 years old. Speaking of butchers, on Saturday, George Bush celebrated the third anniversary of the war he started against the people of Iraq. In his weekly radio address, Bush cited yet another reason for attacking the defenseless nation.
Under Saddam Hussein, Iraq was an enemy of America who shot at airplanes.
Bush said Saturday that the greatest threat to American troops in Iraq comes from ordinary household appliances.
IEDs are homemade bombs that can be hidden in cars or by the side of a road and detonated remotely using everyday devices like garage door openers and cordless phones. These weapons are now the principal threat to our troops and to the future of a free Iraq.
This week will mark the third anniversary of Bush's having told the world that he had lost his patience with Iraq. Another member of the Bush administration may be headed for prison. Claude Allen was Bush's number one domestic policy advisor until he quit unexpectedly last week. Now we know why. Allen, a fundamentalist Christian, was indicted in Maryland for bilking department stores out of about $5,000 in a refund bunco scam. The conservative ran his con more than 25 times against Hex and Target stores. Allen made $161,000 a year in the White House. He was one of the Bush administration nominees for the federal appeals court who was blocked by Democrats a couple of years ago. Allen, beloved by the religious right, is facing as many as 15 years in the penitentiary. The headless bodies of two policemen were found in Afghanistan Saturday. The two had been reported missing a day earlier in Helmand province, a remote desert area in the southern part of the country, after being abducted from their homes. Only 2 weeks ago, George Bush used his radio address to tout the tremendous success he has had bringing peace and freedom to the blasted, poverty-stricken nation. Spain marked the second anniversary of the Madrid train bombings Saturday. Two schoolchildren laid a wreath at the Spanish Forest of Remembrance as Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero and a host of Spanish citizens looked on. After getting out of Iraq, Spain has caught and brought to justice several dozen of those responsible for the bombings. George Bush's administration has neither caught nor killed the mastermind of September 11th. The FBI wants you to be afraid. The agency is warning people that they might be blown to pieces if they go to college basketball games. This is News on the Horn, the head-on radio network.
Hey, have you got a minute?
Huh?
I'm going to say a word. You tell me what comes to mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
Tchaikovsky.
Gesundheit. Okay, what's the word?
No, see, that is the word. What does Tchaikovsky make you think of?
I don't know. Allergy season?
Hey there, how you doing?
What's up?
Who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker.
No kidding.
Yeah, before her there was only soda crackers.
Hard to imagine. Hey, young lady?
Yeah?
Does the name Man Ray mean anything to you?
Duh. The Man Ray is a kind of poisonous jellyfish, and it lives in the Gulf of Mexico.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's very deadly.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music, Martha Graham's dance, and Man Ray's photography. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Jordan has shown itself more capable than the Bush administration in catching and punishing terrorists. The Jordanian government executed two men Saturday who were convicted of the murder of Lawrence Foley, an American diplomat. Foley was slain in 2002 as he walked to his car outside his residence in Amman, Jordan. The body of an American peace activist has been found in Iraq. The State Department announced Friday night after the close of the weekly news cycle that it believed a body found near Baghdad was that of American Tom Fox. Preliminary reports say Fox was bound hand and foot and shot in the head. Fox was abducted November 26th, along with three other Christian peace activists. He did not appear in a video released last week by the kidnappers that was aired on Al Jazeera. Tensions continue to mount between Afghanistan and Pakistan. After after blasting Hamid Karzai last week on U.S. television. Pakistani dictator Pervez Musharraf's forces killed 26 people Saturday in clashes along the mountainous border with Afghanistan. Pakistan used helicopter gunships provided by the United States to attack the peasant villages with rockets and machine gun fire. Iran made it clear Saturday that it is willing to use oil as a weapon if the U.S. continues to push the United Nations towards sanctions against it over its nuclear program. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice continues to reject attempts to negotiate an accord. Another South American country is continuing the trend toward the left and away from the Bush administration. Joyous celebrations took place in Valparaiso, Chile, Saturday, as that country inaugurated its first female president. Michelle Bachelet took office amid parades, fiestas, and a general feeling of goodwill. A who's who leaders took part in the events, including the presidents of Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Venezuela. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, a former coca farmer, gave Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice a guitar decorated with coca leaves. Sadly, George Bush did not attend. For the Head On Radio News Network, I'm Bob Kincaid.
Another edition of Fourth Estate Radio. My name is John Fox, down here in Sydney, Australia. Say good day, Bruce.
Good day, Bruce.
Hey, John, man.
Are you with me, John?
Oh, yeah, I'm there. You hear me? You got me over there?
I've got you over here, buddy. We're constantly working out the bugs here, aren't we, my friend?
Oh, yeah. But something just drastically improved as soon as we went to open up microphones. Wow, whatever that was, keep it that way. Man, what a week, man. What a week. I swear, I don't think I've had much sleep this week. I've just had the most incredible last couple of days. I guarantee you the whole Fisk thing, but... what do you have to start us off? Like, what's burning your butt first out this week, man?
John, I don't know what's burning my butt, but I will tell you what's burning my brain at this point. this has been an incredible week. We've seen, we saw the whole Dubai Ports World thing fall apart. We've watched as more of the grand old party, they call themselves. I'm going to call them greedy old pukes. As they try to, cover up for the cronyism and the corruption. And again, we had a cabinet member resign this week over that exact issue. We got a whole bunch of neat stuff to talk about tonight. And we also have... I'm aware of at least one interview we've got coming tonight, and possibly even a couple. So we'll see how that works out. But I know that we do have one. Our friend Anthony Lowenstein did a piece for us. John, isn't that right?
Yeah, man. Well, as we've kind of talked about, we knew that we were going to have Robert Fisk come down to lecture, which was a real coup on Anthony's part because Anthony was actually in Lebanon with Robert Fisk. When he did research for his book. And we actually thought we were going to lose out on the interview. And last minute, after the book signing and everything, Robert says, "Anthony, my hotel room, now." And we flew down there. And in 5 minutes of getting to his hotel room, had everything set up, and we got just a really, really neat, candid interview. It's fantastic.
Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing that later on in the program. Also, John, I believe we are we're blogging where?
Ah, yeah, man. I got so ready to go into things, we forgot to do the housekeeping. Well, we're blogging at 4thestateradio.com as usual. We're chatting at the TomHartman.com chat room. You go to Tom Hartman any way you want to spell it. Click on the chat link, and you'll fall into a pool of just some of the most interesting and fun-loving people that have brains and like to use them. As usual, our streaming and archiving is done by the White Rose Society at whiterosesociety.org, and Ben is on a fundraiser at the moment, and I think he's almost at his goal, so I think one last push, we can kick him over and he can stop asking for money, because, well, he never sends a bill, so do the right thing. After the show tonight, too, we have the entire Fisk lecture from Sydney's Macquarie University, and I guarantee everybody needs to listen to what this man has to say about the state of the media and the Middle East. He's just undeniably the man.
Now Fisk is a foreign correspondent for The Independent, isn't that right?
Yes, he is, and he's perhaps the most decorated foreign correspondent out there. He's lived over three decades in the Middle East. So, I mean, we're not talking about some guy in a hotel room going down and writing some copy. You know, this guy just, you know, he lives there. And it was interesting, in the lecture during the question and answer, there's one point where someone asked something regarding the West's view, and he turns to me and says, "Mate, I live where you came from. I don't actually spend enough time in the West to tell you what the West thinks about what's happening regarding this particular subject." Because he goes, "I live where you came from."
There you go.
I mean, every question was extremely well thought out and you know, heartfully contemplated. And he was just an animated character. And the only thing with the audio webcast is that you can't see the video footage that he brought. And he does a couple of things. But you hear the audio, and I think you get the vibe. And, in fact, Robert Fisk's article that just came out on The Independent today, which is also available at Information Clearinghouse, is basically all about Antony's book that's coming out and the censorship attempts and issues when you want to speak openly about the Israel-Palestine issue, which both of these men do.
Well, you know, also, I think, John, fantastic, and I can hardly wait. Now, that lecture is going to be at right up immediately following our live program, which will be at 1 o'clock a.m. on the East Coast. 10 p.m. on the West Coast, and what time will that be where you are, John?
It'll be 5 o'clock in the afternoon, mate. Kind of an extension of our Crick's lecture series, and we have another one of those coming up in a couple of weeks. But man, this was just something very, very special, and the university went to great lengths to get me a feed, so we could get this thing, and I mean. I can't even tell you kind of how just flying and buzzed out I was for, you know, like about an entire day after getting done doing that interview, because it one of those situations where you know you're going straight to the best possible source that you can get. And in Antony's interview, he asked him some questions that we didn't hear being asked on his media run as he's been down here in Australia. And there's some interesting insights into the man himself. I just think it's really good. And Antony's going to be a guy that you're going to see a lot more of over the coming, I reckon, year or less. He's going to become a fixture. So let's get on to the top news stories, man.
Yeah, well, we're also chatting in the Tom Hartman chat room. So if you're listening to this program, you want to come in and chat in the Tom Hartman chat room, please do. And also, I wanted to make sure that I wished my good friend Benedict at Large happy birthday, because today is his birthday in the chat room. So happy birthday, Ben.
It's your birthday. Go ahead.
That was actually kind of weird. I like that, John. Do it some more.
No, it's all right, man. We got much more serious business to get on with here. We got 2.5 more hours to have me doing stupid things on air. So.
Well, we had a really great feedback from our last show regarding mangoes, and you know, so all of you who sent emails and got in touch with us regarding our mango madness last week, thank you. We had a great time with that. We're not going to do mangoes again tonight, although actually we actually are as we're talking about them, aren't we, John? But
I'm not in the chat room, but I can only imagine the movie game has started again. I mean, it went on 3 days afterwards, but that was funny. I think everybody needed a good laugh.
Yeah. Well, you know, you want to hear some opposite world news?
Oh, please, please. I mean, what else is there?
Well, here's an opposite world news story that I think we all need to, like, pay attention to. And that is that the United States now has put Iran at the top of its list of countries that have the worst human rights abuses. How about that, John? What do you think about that? Now, this is along with North Korea, Burma, Zimbabwe, Cuba, and Belarus.
Well, there's been a lot on this subject recently, because even the Chinese, which I have here somewhere here, China lashes back at the U.S. for its criticisms of. And so, I mean, it's all a bunch of calling the kettle black stuff here, I reckon, if you want to know the bloody truth.
Well, that is the bloody truth. It's let me just read this. In a 16-page introduction, the report also singled out the human rights performances of Syria, Sudan, Nepal, Russia, and Venezuela as particularly problematic through the year, even as it praised what it called major progress in Iraq, as well as advances in Afghanistan, Colombia, Ukraine, Lebanon, Burundi, and Liberia. According to the introduction, in Iraq, 2005 was a year of major progress for democracy, democratic rights, and freedom.
Right, we're bombing their asses straight to freedom.
I can't help but laugh because it's totally, and I'm being corrected as I'm speaking, that's Belarus. I apologize to my good friend Ben Birch, my cousin Ben, who sent me a message saying that's Belarus. Maybe he's from there, I'm not sure. At the latest edition of country reports, which were first mandated by Congress in 1976, covers the human rights situations of nearly 200 countries in 2005 and stretches more than 3,000 pages in length. And I dare say that on each and every page is some opposite world news. So.
Well, the Chinese article makes some interesting points about the rates of black and African-American incarceration and how, you know, America's human rights records isn't all that shiny either at the moment. So, you know, who's saying what to who at the moment? Yeah, it's opposite world all around, and I just think so much of the planet's just in the man.
Well, it makes you wonder exactly about the, I'm hearing some music. John, you want to take us out there, bud?
Okay, man. Well, you know, I think it's getting on 18 minutes after the hour. You listen to Fourth Estate Radio. We're blogging at fourthestateradio.com. Chatting with Tom Hartman, chat room, and Bruce and I will be right back.
Hi, this is Guy James. Remember me? As many of you know, I got the boot from the radio stations that carried my show a while back because I got a little too controversial for them to handle. Well, I'm back now, but I'll be doing my show 5 days a week from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time starting on March 20th. You can join us at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org. And if you like hard-hitting, thought-provoking, entertaining radio, then join us starting March 20th at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org for the new Guy James Show.
Head on. He's back.
Yes, I am.
Listen live every night. HeadOnRadio.com.
Your computer is your radio. No static, no low power signal. It's easy. Bob Kincaid, West Virginia's number one liberal talker, is back on the air. Bigger, badder, and better than ever. Head on with Bob Kincaid, just like you remember him. Feisty, ferocious, and foremost, fact-based. No right-wing spin, no falafel, no oxycontin. Just a nightly confrontation with the facts, the issues of the day. Head on. Listen live every night.
Listen live every night. HeadOnRadio.com.
Click on air every weeknight from 7:06 to 10 p.m. Then call 877-443-2366. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. It's easy.
It's talk radio for the rest of us.
Monday through Friday night, 7 to 10.
Head on.
Every 3 minutes, another woman gets the news that she has breast cancer. And here are some of the first words she hears. HER2 new Oncogene aromatase inhibitor, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How are you going to decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Please listen to me, Marvin Hamlisch. As soon as you get your diagnosis, go to breastcancer.org. It's a special place on the internet where you can learn how to say all those breast cancer words and find out what they mean. At breastcancer.org, you can learn more about your particular kind of cancer and your treatment options. Prepare a list of questions for your next doctor's visit and get all kinds of other useful information to guide you and your family through this. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Dad, let's sing that bedtime song.
Rock-a-bye baby by Newton's treetop. His first law of motion, make sure you won't stop. The same rules of physics apply to a ball. While gravity is a force that makes things fall.
By the sixth grade, many girls lose interest in math and science. But it's never too early to set your daughter's future in motion. For some simple ideas, go to girlsgotech.org.
A public service announcement brought to you by Girl Scouts of USA and Ad Council.
All right, we're back on Fourth Estate Radio. This is Bruce Birch, and my good friend John Fox is down there in Australia. John, you with us?
Oh, yeah, man, I love that track.
Isn't that great? That's Mr. Frank Zappa with Captain Beefheart doing the vocals there.
Man, it's just too much fun. but I want the ya-ya-ya-ya-ya's again.
Well, we'll do the, we'll pop that one in later in the show. I'm sure it'll pop up there. You know, we were talking about Iran on the way out to the break, and I just wanted to mention before we moved on from that story that it amazes me that the United States State Department would actually even attempt to write a report about human rights abuses now, in a time when it is probably guilty of some of the worst human rights abuses going on around the world. You know, with the torture and with the rendition that, you know, which is basically nothing more than, which is kidnapping, basically. You know, and the concentration camps around the world. I think they're building some actually in or building one that we're aware of in North Africa, in Morocco, a huge one. So it blows my mind, John, that they would write a 3,000-page report and not write about the very same things that they're doing, that this country is doing, which to me is completely reprehensible.
Well, I mean, come on, man. You know, it's the whole denial thing that, you know, denying that any of what the United States is doing is possibly illegal, even though we know that it is. What really, really kind of scares me is that this Patriot 2 thing seems to be sliding through, and I mean, there's some really, really, really scary stuff when it comes to detainment and, you know, and whatnot going there. You know, the Halliburton special projects prisons, all that kind of stuff, man, I'm really, really getting worried about where are we going and can we change the direction?
Well, and I think a lot of that depends on whether or not we get someone in, people in Congress that are going to, you know, be a check and balance. As it stands, you know, the Justice Department is moving hard, moving quickly and swiftly to try to force local governments to buy up the Diebold machines because of the HAVA, the Help America Vote Act deadlines. You know,
yeah.
So. I don't know. I mean, I got to tell you that I'm kind of, you know, I'm going to be perfectly honest in how I feel about it. I feel very squirrely about this fall's election.
Oh, May.
There are probably solid blue areas, solid Democratic areas that are going to go Republican for no apparent reason whatsoever.
I mean, I know that we've gone, you know, off track from where you were, but this is the scary thing that actually all this stuff ends up coming back to the voter issue. The fact that we have illegitimate people doing illegitimate and illegal things in our name, and somehow we got to get control of that back. And so then, you know, they continue to go pompously on accusing the rest of the world of things while they seem to feel that they can openly have the same conduct. And just by the spin, and this is where some of the stuff in the Fisk interview, if you think about what we're told and what we've been told more and more over the decades, man, you know, we're heading straight into moving the everlasting war for everlasting peace from Afghanistan to Iraq. Next stop, Iran. Next stop after that is, well, take your pick. Is it going to be Pakistan or is it going to be India?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I think that's probably what's going to be at least 12 to 15 years down the road when we've all forgotten about the infamous trip of nukes for mangoes.
Yeah, man, and you know, here's the question I want to pose to you, man. It's all about context, right? How
sure.
they continue to be able to keep this mess going by pulling things constantly away from their true context. How do we get back and maintain the context? I mean, just look, in this short segment before we run out of time, you and I have sidetracked in about 8 different directions and still been able to keep the thing connected.
Right.
You know, so I mean, well, like, how, you know...
Go ahead.
What do we do, man? This is my question. What do we do?
Well, I think pushing the truth is the biggest part of it, because what this government has done is... to take whatever the truth is and put out an alternative version of it, opposite world, as you and I like to call it, and,
yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it's true or not, they have been able to successfully push that on certain parts of the media, and certain parts of the media will completely pick it up and run with it, hence why we created Fourth Estate Radio. You know what I'm saying? Is that there is a truth that needs to be told, and it's not being told on corporate media. It's being told on programs such as ours, such as Head On with Bob Kincaid, Grace and Rama, Joe Vecchio's program. I mean, you know, all of us who are trying to get the truth out there. The truth is that this government is guilty of war crimes. That is without dispute. Would you agree, John?
I have no doubt about it. And, you know, we need some, you know, we need to be able to ask the right questions and find out just how bad the war crimes are. But I think a lot of it's pretty clear. And this is, I mean, you hear these things kind of, you hear yourself say these things and you all of a sudden have become a screaming anti-American liberal, but that's not the case. Anyway, Cup of Joe coming up next. He's got a fundraiser going on. CupofJoe.blogspot.com. This is John and Bruce, and we'll be right back.
It's the Cup of Joe Report. I'm Joe Vecchio. Now that Judge Alito was on the bench, states are lining up to be the first one with a test case to challenge Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling legalizing abortions that's been a rallying cry for so-called conservatives ever since. First up at the plate is South Dakota, which just signed the most restrictive laws against abortion since pre-Roe days. According to the legislation, anyone performing an abortion is guilty of a Class 5 felony with a penalty of up to 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. That's a bit less than what you would get if you committed first-degree murder, so I guess they're not quite ready yet to put an unborn fetus at the same level as an adult. My question is this. If a woman has a miscarriage, is there a murder investigation to see if it was intentional? Silly question, you say. That's not the intent of the law. But if that's not the intent, then what is? And who is the law meant for? You don't think for 1 minute that the rich and powerful won't find ways to go around it. Maybe, as in the case with anti-sodomy laws, it's meant to go after only a certain group of people. I think you know who I mean. I wish I had an easy answer for all this, but I don't, and neither, I suspect, does anyone else. So much of this is political grandstanding, and I don't know who's worse, the people who really believe in the so-called sanctity of life, or the ones just using it as an issue for their own gain. The only prediction I'll make is that until we start talking about this issue and others, honestly, with ourselves and others, this idiocy will continue. I'll get back to work. This has been the Cup of Joe Report by Joe Vecchio. Listen to the Cup of Joe radio show, available via streaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com.
If you missed last Sunday's All Things Reconsidered with Bruce Birch, here's some highlights. You know, stuff like that we hear about that sickens us, or that creates the kind of attitude in our thinking that is just like, we can't believe that people would actually do this. The reason why we think that is because we are basically good people, and we want to help other people. We don't want to hurt other people. We want to help other people. Now, speaking for myself, this week I plan to do something to go out and help someone else. And I would strongly encourage that you do the same thing, because the only way that we're going to be able to turn this world around and to change anything is we've got to create the kind of world that we want to live in. And that means that instead of fussing about how bad things are, we've got to go out and do something good to turn it around. And if doing that something good means going and working on a Habitat house, if that's what you want to do, then by all means, please go do it. If doing something good means going down to the local homeless shelter and feeding the folks there, if doing something good means, you know, volunteering your time with some kids or going to the hospital and reading to cancer patients or whatever it might be, that's fine. But do it. Because that, by doing that, that's how we create the world that we want. That's how we create the world that we want. Join me every Sunday as we talk about how to make this world a better place. 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific. That's allthingsreconsidered.org, a proud member of the Head On Radio Network.
Introducing Pablo Escobar, trained at the School of the Americas. Another day making hay up in Hollywood.
Over there, John, still with us?
Yeah, man, somewhere up there, coming through the screaming jets. Yes, I am. hey, man, you seem to have something about a racism issue you wanted to bring up here, didn't you?
Well, I do, and we have a guest that's going to be coming on very shortly. But before we did that, I wanted to talk about the passing of a Southern civil rights pioneer by the name of Ann Braden. Ann Braden was catapulted into national headlines in 1954 when she and her husband, Carl, were indicted for sedition for their leadership in desegregating a Louisville, Kentucky suburb. They purchased a house in an all-white neighborhood on behalf of African-Americans Andrew and Charlotte Wade, and this violated Louisville's color line and provoked violence against both families, culminating with the dynamiting of the house in June of 1954.
Jesus.
This is a pretty hairy situation. A subsequent grand jury investigation concentrated not on the neighborhood's harassment of the Wades, but looked to the Bradens' supposedly communistic intentions in backing the purchase, and as a result, they were indicted for sedition. Their case made national news and earned them the ire of segregationists across the South, which of course endears them to me, which was reeling from the U.S. Supreme Court's condemnation of school segregation in the Brown ruling. Only Carl was convicted, and later that conviction was overturned. Apparently the sedition charges left them pariahs, branded as radicals and Reds in the Cold War South, and they became fierce civil libertarians who openly espoused left-wing social critiques but would never embrace nor disavow the Communist Party publicly because they felt that to do so would accept the terms of the 1950s anti-communist witch hunts. She died, this lady, Ann Braden, died this past week. And throughout the rest of her life, starting with that single act, she created... She was just a one-person force of six decades of activism, and you know, she was also a journalist, you know, another member of the Fourth Estate, who covered the civil rights movement in Alabama in 1947 and through the 50s, and you know, just an amazing woman.
So as soon as and actually we're going to have someone on to talk about here in just a few minutes. But John, I wanted to really sort of like set that up a little bit because, you know, one of the things that we are we're beginning to see many of those pioneers of the civil rights movement. They're starting to leave us. They're starting to pass away. And it won't be long before there won't be any left. And, you know, I just, we have to honor these folks because they really made some tough decisions when, at a time, when making those decisions would basically, you know, their friends, everyone would turn on them, you know. So
I'm speechless at the story, but I think, yeah, we're hitting a time in our own history where we're going to lose these people that know what it is to stand up for what's right, even when it could actually cost you your life, because we're coming up on those times. And maybe it's because it's suddenly in our short attention span theater society that we've kind of really forgotten about the lessons that these people taught. I can't even say so much me, because I'm part of the generation where all this part of history was just kind of tried to be avoided in education. Thank you, Ronnie Reagan.
Yes. Yeah, you know, and that's, you're absolutely right. You know, the 60s was what, one paragraph in a textbook?
Yeah, and I remember asking when I went in to see my guidance counselor, you know, before, you know, senior year or something, and going and picking classes. And I asked, I said, you know, we have, you know, 8 different Civil War quarters that you can take, you know, all this different European and American history, all this great stuff, one quarter of what they called modern history. And it like basically stopped at the Apollo landing. And it's just, you know, and everyone said it was just too close. It wasn't worthy. It wasn't yet old enough to be taught in schools was the excuse. And it just didn't make, that never made any sense to me, but now I see why. The right-wing agenda that was already started with the way that they played budgets and whatnot in schools starting back in the Ronnie Reagan era, you know, I was a good example of what that could become, a blind person who just sat there going, blah, 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 right-winger garbage, until I started to actually read up on what no one ever just, you know, bothered to tell me before.
Well, you know, and actually women like this are the women that have changed society, John. And the crazy thing is that we haven't seen a profound outpouring of folks, you know, like this, like we did in the 60s. Maybe we will very soon. On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, who is the biographer of Ann Braden. Kate, how are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing all right. It's been a very, very sad time here in Louisville where I live and where Ann lived.
Well, tell us a little bit about Ann, Kate, if you can, because, you know, I kind of set this up a little bit, but I'd love to hear, you know, just some of the things that she was able to accomplish in her life.
Okay. Well, you know, I got interested in Ann's life because of her being a white Southern voice against racism, and she was active along those lines for almost 6 decades, since she was a very young woman in her early 20s. She died last Monday in Louisville at 81, and she was just as immersed in the fight against racism and white supremacy and the drive to get white people to open their eyes to those realities and get more active. She was just as active last week as she was, you know, in 1948, in 1968, in 1988. So to me, that is an interesting dynamic about her life, is the tenacity of this anti-racist message. And then also, the certainly for her generation, it was unusual, the extent of commitment to that particular issue on the part of a white Southern woman.
Well, and also dangerous in that time, wasn't it?
Very dangerous, yes. She's been threatened. She had 2 cars burned, and this was after after she was very well known and had been indicted for sedition in Kentucky twice and was quite a pariah. But in the 1970s, during her support for busing to achieve school desegregation, you know, there was a huge outpouring of Klan presence in Louisville, and she had two cars burned twice in her driveway.
Oh, so this
was a woman with enormous courage, too.
So what kinds of, I mean, you know, what kinds of changes? Now, I know that in 1954 she helped segregate a Louisville neighborhood, and as a result was indicted for sedition. Is that correct?
Right. Important to remember that this, of course, was the height of the Cold War and the Red Scare that's popularly known as McCarthyism. Of course, it started before Joe McCarthy started his crusade, but in the South, the way that manifested itself in the 1950s was many segregationists hitched their star to anti-communism, and that's really just what happened in Louisville. This was she and her husband, Carl Braden, who were an activist team for many, many years until his death back in 1975, but they acted as the front for an African-American couple in Louisville that had been trying to buy the house on, you know, on their own. They had the money. They were just like so many other young. He was a World War II veteran family during that time. They wanted to move to the suburbs, and no suburban realtor in Louisville would sell them a house. And so Ann and Carl agreed to act as the front to just simply make the purchase for them, then deed it over to them. And actually, Louisville was not quite as rabidly segregated and racist as the deeper South, kind of the Black Belt South. And there had been a lot of moves towards desegregating a lot of different aspects of Louisville. So they really didn't expect the kind of outcry they got. But just coincidentally, that purchase, they moved into that house, the Wades, or the African-American family, they moved in the very weekend before the Supreme Court condemned school segregation in Brown. So a lot of people would argue, and I'm one of them, that that both the Wades and the Bradens, as their white supporters, kind of caught a lot of the white backlash in that area because people were afraid, or a lot of whites were afraid of sort of larger racial changes on the horizon.
So Ann Braden, and you know, this is a saint among many saints, and we're beginning to lose the presence of many of these folks. Coretta Scott King just passed away recently, and now Ann Braden. You know, what kinds of impacts did she have in a more of a national front?
Well, a national front, I think, because there were not too many whites who were white Southerners, certainly, who were such ardent allies of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, she really stands out as someone who was kind of a beacon there and who really inspired a lot of other whites. You know, I'm not a quantitative historian. I don't deal with numbers. I deal with talking to people and looking at, you know, newspaper archives and letters and that sort of thing. But I dare say that if you could just sort of arbitrarily line up, you know, 20 whites of the 1960s, the baby boomer generation that got active in the sit-ins and SNCC and later. But if you talk to 20 whites, more than half of them were either recruited or really sort of nurtured in the movement by Ann and Carl Braden in those years. So that was like one important impact. I think another impact is just because she was a bit of a pariah, because those sedition charges were really on the basis of her and her husband's alleged communism. And they were certainly avowed socialists and Marxists, and they really were always trying to make the connection between, you know, it's bigger than a hamburger. It's not just about desegregating lunch counters. We got to get jobs. And then making the connection with, like, international politics and racism and imperialism abroad. So I think that she was one of several important voices that really encouraged a kind of broader vision of social change in the civil rights movement, and especially in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. You know, so she was also making connections between civil rights and civil liberties because of that kind of, you know, the sedition charges and the notoriety that she and her husband won because of them.
Now she was or was not an avowed Marxist?
She was an avowed Marxist. When it comes to membership in the Communist Party, that is a question that she would never answer right up until the end of her life. So her, but her position was she would never disavow the Communist Party. She would never purify herself by saying, no, I wasn't in it. She would never buy into what she felt was buying into the anti-communist Red Scare by either saying, no, I'm not in it and purifying herself, or saying, yes, I am in it or I was in it, and losing all, being discredited as communists were in that era. So her view was very much of a kind of First Amendment stand.
Sure. Sure.
The right to free association. And she never really would answer that question right up until the end of her life. And my biography of her discusses that, but it doesn't try to place her either within or outside the Communist Party. What is the case is that she was very close to a lot of Communist Party-led campaigns and served as an elector for the Communist Party in Louisville, her hometown, several times in the 60s and 70s, which was more controversial then than it sounds now.
Sure, sure. My co-host John Fox also has a question or a couple of things he wanted to talk to you about.
Kate, I tell you, thanks for coming on, and I think you kind of answered basically what I was going to ask in your last couple of statements, but she was actually part of what was then the legitimate Communist Party as an elector, but to have admitted to it would have ended up creating the kind of scare factor, boo factor that was around the whole Communist Red Scare, which actually encompassed a whole other thing than what communism actually was.
Is that... So by serving as an elector for the Communist Party, that you don't have to be in the party to do that. You simply have to be willing to take a public stand saying that it should be part of the legitimate political spectrum, the political discourse. So that was really her reasoning there.
It was definitely sounds like a very pure type of First Amendment stance to take, and I could see having no choice, and just I cannot imagine the cost to be paid, you know, to suddenly become a social political pariah in your own home country for actually just kind of helping support the process, which is our democracy.
Well, that's true. And, of course, I think really what happened with the generation of students that really kind of broke down Jim Crow segregation, they began to reclaim her. A lot of this real kind of pariah status had really been placed onto her and her husband, Carl, during the 50s as a result of that Louisville sedition case, which a lot of segregationists all over the South, in Congress, in elected office, they would lift those charges up again and again and again and say they were convicted Reds, you know. And, well, what he was convicted of was sedition. She was actually never even tried. The charges were dropped. His conviction was eventually overturned. And the charge was sedition, not communism anyway. So, you know, I think that in itself is an example of the way that the segregationist Southern politicians at that time would just use whatever form of legitimacy they could to cloak segregation, because it really was collapsing, and in order to prop it up, you know, anti-communism had a sort of legitimacy at that time.
And Bruce. I guess also Kate Fossil, and actually your website is what's your website address, Kate?
It's the title of my book. The title of the biography that I published of Anne 3 years ago is Subversive Southerner, and the subtitle, you know, kind of gets to what I'm talking about here, which is Ann Braden and the struggle for racial justice in the Cold War South. Well, they like those long academic titles. But the website is www.subversivesoutherner.com, as if it's one word, no space in there, subversivesoutherner.com. And we did update the website. I sort of run that website myself with the help of my partner. And it's updated with the news about her death and some of the there's a huge community memorial planned, and it is here in Louisville to honor her life on April the 23rd of this year. But it's very national in scope. There are people like, you know, Angela Davis and, you know, possibly Cornell West, who were very, very attached to Anne, both as a human being, but also in like this, in honor of this enormous commitment. So there's details about that on the website. And, you know, it's just a very big event for those who, you know, sort of look at this movement over the long haul. This week was a great loss with her passing, and quite unexpectedly, I might add. Even though she was 81, she was very, very vibrant and still active.
What? Let me ask you this, Kate. I don't know if you're able to answer this question, but I do know. I mean, you know, in the 50s and 60s, the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, was very active in the South. How much activity was there in Louisville at the time in regards, and how much of the was there a lot of friction between Ann and Klan? I mean, you know, Klan members or. Was there anything related to that?
You actually didn't see a lot of the Klan in Louisville in the 50s. You saw a lot more of it in the 70s around busing. But what you did see in the 50s, and this was certainly more pronounced the further south you went, like it was most pronounced perhaps in Mississippi, but in Louisville and in parts of central Kentucky, there were these white citizens' councils that formed. And the historian Charles Payne has a great quote I like. He's like, they had the politics, the demeanor of the Klan with the sort of clothing and, you know, an appearance of the Rotary Club.
Right.
And the White Citizens Council grew up in Kentucky, right straight out of that housing desegregation case that the Bradens and the Wades were involved in that I was describing a little bit ago. So this was very much responding to that particular action, and it was they who really circulated the idea that this was, because this, they really legitimately, the charge was based on the idea that this was all a communist plot to bring down the government of Kentucky and destabilize U.S. race relations. That sounds crazy by our lights today, but it was easier for many white Louisvillians to consider that than it was to consider that, you know, this African-American man wanted a house in the suburbs and had a, you know, a right and a privilege to it. And they couldn't, and that whites would care enough to help him do it. They just could not quite, you know, comprehend that at that moment in time.
Kate Fossil, what kind of parallels are there, you know, with some of that that happened in the 50s and 60s and today that are
obvious?
Well,
of course, it's not an identical parallel, but I can't, you know, when my book came out, it was September 11th was still very fresh. And the, you know, the sort of anti-terrorist campaign has not really got, I think, quite the sort of emotional oomph in American culture that the anti-communist Red Hunt had. But it could get to that. There certainly are some parallels in those the response to, you know, the crackdown on civil liberties in response to this this alleged communist takeover that could happen, and the crackdown on civil liberties that happened in the wake of September 11th as justified by the terrorist attacks. So again, I don't want to draw a complete parallel, but I think there are some shades of similarity there.
Yeah. What was Ann Braden working on at the time of her passing, Kate?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, over the last few years, she had become a teacher, and she was teaching social justice history courses, both at the university where I'm on the faculty, the University of Louisville, and also at Northern Kentucky University, which was quite, it's quite a little drive. It's about an hour and 45 minutes from Louisville, and she had actually become so frail that she was having to get people to drive her up there every week. She was still doing that. So let's see, last Wednesday, a week ago, she taught that class in Northern Kentucky, came back to Louisville, was very involved with some local, went off to a meeting that Thursday evening when she got back. And then on Friday, she completed a proposal which she submitted to a the Kentucky Foundation for Women to try and underwrite an arts and activism summer camp for young women in Louisville's West End, which is its predominantly African-American section of town. And the Kentucky Alliance, the organization she worked with, had sponsored that camp last summer, and she wanted to see it again this summer. She had submitted that proposal on Friday, and she became very ill on Saturday and had to be hospitalized. But I will tell you, no one really thought it was this serious. I myself, and she and I became very close friends after that book came out. I thought it was a relief that she was going into the hospital because now she could rest. Because this woman, when I say she lived her life for justice, I mean quite literally, because this woman drove herself and worked on these causes really around the clock every day of her life. She was just that sort of person.
She just sounds like an amazing person. Kate, we're hammering up to a break, but I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us on the program tonight. And and all the best to you and to, in all of your endeavors, and thank you for sharing sharing Ann with us.
Well, thanks so much. And the last thing I have to say is she always promoted women's leadership in the movement, and that was very important at that time too. So
fantastic. Well, we'll try to get
lovely,
you back
Kate.
On again
thank you so much.
Soon.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
And that
wow,
is Kate Fossil.
Wow, that was incredible, man. That was just incredible. Before you take us out, because I know the music's coming in any second, right after we come back from the news, in the next half hour, we're going to have Anthony Lowenstein interview with Robert Fitz.
Yes,
and as usual,
Anthony with Robert Fisk.
Oh, man, it's going to be stop, man.
Okay, yeah. This is 4th Estate Radio. You're listening to Bruce Birch and John Fox. We'll be right back after the top of the hour and the news.
Twin soldiers and Nixon coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming for dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it. Soldiers are hunting us down.
Treat me with understanding.
Treat me with respect.
Drug and alcohol addiction is an equal opportunity disease.
Treat me without judgment.
Individuals in recovery come from all walks of life and deserve to be treated with respect for winning one of the hardest battles there is.
Treat me with courtesy.
Treat me with humanity.
Alcohol and drug addiction deserves proper treatment. For drug and alcohol information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP.
Tom DeLay, indicted for criminal money laundering, pocketed tens of thousands in campaign contributions from indicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff, 48 trips to golf resorts, 100 flights aboard company jets, 200 nights at world-class resorts and hotels, $1 million from Russian tycoons to allegedly influence his vote. $1 million from Russian tycoons? What else will we uncover about Tom DeLay? It's time for DeLay to resign.
Hi, my name is Joanne, and I have mannequinism. Well, I did have it, but I'm not a mannequin anymore. Doctors said over 75% of my body turned into plastic, They said it's because I wasn't active in my community, because I didn't vote or volunteer or I don't know. All I wanted to do was cry, but I couldn't because I had plastic eyes.
Protect yourself from mannequinism. Log on to fightmannequinism.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No, no more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORA-KID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Yugoslavian war criminal Slobodan Milosevic is dead. In a scene reminiscent of the end of Hermann Göring, Milosevic was found dead in his cell at The Hague on Saturday. No cause of death has been established. The United Nations is investigating. Milosevic was standing trial for crimes against humanity stemming from the bloody Balkan civil war that followed the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. The butcher from Belgrade, as he was known, was 64 years old. Speaking of butchers, on Saturday, George Bush celebrated the third anniversary of the war he started against the people of Iraq. In his weekly radio address, Bush cited yet another reason for attacking the defenseless nation.
Under Saddam Hussein, Iraq was an enemy of America who shot at airplanes.
Bush said Saturday that the greatest threat to American troops in Iraq comes from ordinary household appliances.
IEDs are homemade bombs that can be hidden in cars or by the side of a road and detonated remotely using everyday devices like garage door openers and cordless phones. These weapons are now the principal threat to our troops and to the future of a free Iraq.
This week will mark the third anniversary of Bush's having told the world that he had lost his patience with Iraq. Another member of the Bush administration may be headed for prison. Claude Allen was Bush's number one domestic policy advisor until he quit unexpectedly last week. Now we know why. Allen, a fundamentalist Christian, was indicted in Maryland for bilking department stores out of about $5,000 in a refund bunco scam. The conservative ran his con more than 25 times against Hex and Target stores. Allen made $161,000 a year in the White House. He was one of the Bush administration nominees for the federal appeals court, who was blocked by Democrats a couple of years ago. Allen, beloved by the religious right, is facing as many as 15 years in the penitentiary. The headless bodies of two policemen were found in Afghanistan Saturday. The two had been reported missing a day earlier in Helmand province, a remote desert area in the southern part of the country, after being abducted from their homes. Only 2 weeks ago, George Bush used his radio address to tout the tremendous success he has had bringing peace and freedom to the blasted, poverty-stricken nation. Spain marked the second anniversary of the Madrid train bombings Saturday. Two schoolchildren laid a wreath at the Spanish Forest of Remembrance as Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero and a host of Spanish citizens looked on. After getting out of Iraq, Spain has caught and brought to justice several dozen of those responsible for the bombings. George Bush's administration has neither caught nor killed the mastermind of September 11th. The FBI wants you to be afraid. The agency is warning people that they might be blown to pieces if they go to college basketball games. This is News on the Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Hey, have you got a minute? I'm going to say a word. You tell me what comes to mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
Tchaikovsky.
Gesundheit. Okay, what's the word?
No, see, that is the word. What does Tchaikovsky make you think of?
I don't know. Allergy season?
Hey there, how you doing?
What's up?
Who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker.
No kidding.
Yeah, before her there was only soda crackers.
Hard to imagine. Hey, young lady.
Yeah?
Does the name Man Ray mean anything to you?
Duh. The Man Ray is a kind of poisonous jellyfish, and it lives in the Gulf of Mexico.
Aha.
It's very deadly.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music, Martha Graham's dance, and Man Ray's photography. Art Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Jordan has shown itself more capable than the Bush administration in catching and punishing terrorists. The Jordanian government executed two men Saturday who were convicted of the murder of Lawrence Foley, an American diplomat. Foley was slain in 2002 as he walked to his car outside his residence in Amman, Jordan. The body of an American peace activist has been found in Iraq. The State Department announced Friday night after the close of the weekly news cycle that it believed a body found near Baghdad was that of American Tom Fox. Preliminary reports say Fox was bound hand and foot and shot in the head. Fox was abducted November 26th, along with three other Christian peace activists. He did not appear in a video released last week by the kidnappers that was aired on Al Jazeera. Tensions continue to mount between Afghanistan and Pakistan. After blasting Hamid Karzai last week on U.S. television, Pakistani dictator Pervez Musharraf's forces killed 26 people Saturday in clashes along the mountainous border with Afghanistan. Pakistan used helicopter gunships provided by the United States to attack the peasant villages with rockets and machine gun fire. Iran made it clear Saturday that it is willing to use oil as a weapon if the U.S. continues to push the United Nations towards sanctions against it over its nuclear program. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice continues to reject attempts to negotiate an accord. Another South American country is continuing the trend toward the left and away from the Bush administration. Joyous celebrations took place in Valparaiso, Chile, Saturday, as that country inaugurated its first female president. Michelle Bachelet took office amid parades, fiestas, and a general feeling of goodwill. A who's who of left-leaning leaders from South America took part in the events, including the presidents of Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Venezuela. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, a former coca farmer, gave Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice a guitar decorated with coca leaves. Sadly, George Bush did not attend. For the Head-On Radio News Network, I'm Bob Kincaid.
I'm John Fox in Sydney, Australia, on a bright and sunny day down here. It's a Sunday afternoon, and Bruce, you're still there with me, man.
I certainly am still with you, my friend.
Oh, well.
Echo coming back, but it's okay.
It's all good.
It's all good. John, that was a fantastic little segment we had with Kate Fossil, SubversiveSoutherner.com. We're all going to hear, now we're going to listen to an interview, when I understand, but before we do that, if you want to get your pen and paper ready, folks, after this segment, you can call us and have your own conversation with John and Bruce by dialing 1-877-443-2366. That's 1-877, the number 4, head on. John, take it away, my friend.
All right, man. Well, so, like, as I've been kind of babbling on endlessly about, Robert Fisk gave a lecture this weekend on Friday at Macquarie University, and it was just rocking. And, you know, it was just a call that decided to the largest on the campus, which holds some, I don't know, someone said 600, I think probably a little higher. But they had AV feeds going out to four other theaters, and some say it was at least 1,000. I don't know. I think about 1,600 people showed up. It felt like a rock concert. And
wow.
It was like an intellectual rock concert. It was really, really cool. So, I mean, I really want you know, folks to hang out and listen to the lecture after our show's over. But at the last minute, when we thought we lost it, Anthony, who, like I said, has spent time with Robert and they're good friends, we got a few minutes with him down at the hotel, which was really cool. It was after everything was over, you know, and it was just great. So, Bob, if you have that, just get ready to run this. This is Anthony Lowenstein, journalist and blogger down here in Sydney. You can get him at AnthonyLowenstein.com. He's got a permanent link on our website at 4thEstateRadio.com. And He's got a pretty controversial book coming out himself very soon. So go ahead and roll this, Bob. This is Anthony Lawrence.
This is an interview with Robert Fisk in Sydney on March the 10th, 2006. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Let me ask you first a very brief question. You've often been very critical of Western journalists, particularly in the US.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask why you think they're particularly failing, and is it a loss of nerves, particularly in the US, or...
Well, I think the historical background does actually go back to the McCarthy era. You know, the Edward Marmorrow era, that wonderful film, you know, Good Night and Good Luck. Is a film journalists should see, all journalists, especially American journalists, but journalists everywhere, and people who want to be journalists should see it. I think it goes back to there. I think there's always been in America this feeling that to be a journalist and question your country's foreign policy, especially in time of war, which means always, according to George W. Bush, is somehow unpatriotic and thus potentially subversive.
Mm.
And add to that the enormous pressures, which do exist for US-American journalists, well, as they do for all of us, but more the Americans,
yeah,
from those supporters of Israel in the major lobby groups in the United States, like AIPAC.
Mm.
And what has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
Mm.
If you start talking about the wall as opposed to the fence or the security barrier, the same thing can happen. When you start telling the truth that Israeli soldiers can be very brutal, as well as Palestinian suicide bombers, you will be accused of being anti-Semitic. Or the editor will be bombarded with letters from outraged readers, all of whom are supporters of Israel, asking why they is employing an anti-Semite, blah, blah, blah. And this scurrilous, outrageous lie that innocent, decent journalists are anti-Semites does frighten some reporters. And it frightens them not only because they want to say they're not. I mean, I threaten to sue people who say that to me. I attack them. But not only because they don't want to hear it said, but they don't want their editors to feel, well, there must be something wrong with so-and-so out in Jerusalem. I mean, the things he's writing, he's upsetting a lot of people, right? And then, of course, all that comes from that is that you have a visit from a delegation of supporters of Israel and the ambassador complains. And so in the United States, where this sort of thing is particularly... I mean, if we have a campaign mounted against me by a particular group, we simply ignore them. We're not into campaigns. Individual readers can write what they think, mm-hmm, but we don't take campaigns. I mean, I had one from supporters of Israel, and we got letters in from places like Texas. I will never buy your magazine again. Well, unfortunately, we're not on sale in Texas. I wish we were, and we're certainly not a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
But these were people who had obviously been told to write, told to create a campaign of scurrilous innuendo, and my editor just puts it in the bin. We're just not interested.
Do you find this loss of nerve is increasingly happening in the UK as well? Or do you think it's particularly...
No,
the US?
I don't think so particularly. European reporting on the Middle East is infinitely more comprehensive and comprehensible than American reporting. I mean, the problem now is that there's so many weasel words introduced into American journalism on the Middle East that it's incomprehensible. I mean, if I'm in New York and I buy the New York Times, I simply don't know what's happening in Gaza, Palestine, Israel, Iraq, for that matter. I mean, you know, every time the Americans said that the insurgents were dead-enders or Saddam remnants, which they clearly weren't, the name has popped up and now I notice Taliban remnants has popped up in the papers. You know, reporters who normally say, oh, we can't put any point of view in, we've got to have a quote, are actually using the words of government and are putting a government point of view in. But that apparently is okay because American officials say has now become the rubric for confirming anything that they want to put in the paper.
Since you've been in Australia, you've been here twice now, I presume you've read some of the papers and
yeah, I've been reading the papers.
Got a bit of a sense. Do you get a similar sense that the media is having the same troubles here than they would be, say, in the US or the UK? Or what's your sense of the media here?
Well, I haven't been coming to Australia frequently enough to be able to see the changes and the transitions during the press. I mean, at the moment, you're obviously obsessed with the Australian Wheat Board, and I can well see why, and indeed I'm becoming obsessed with it to the point I might be writing about it for my own paper very soon.
Mm.
I think the point is that, you know, if you look at your general reporting out of the Middle East, a lot of it is agency wire copy, and it suffers from, you know, it's Associated Press, it suffers from the same problem as the American journalism does. I mean, it obviously makes a difference on a community how they read and what they read. A good example is in, you know, another Commonwealth countries in Canada. If you talk to English-speaking Canadians about the Middle East, they tend to have not a very clear and sharp idea of the actual issues and the injustices, for example, that have been visited upon the Palestinians. If you talk to French Canadians, they're much more up to date and more sensitive to the issue. And it took me several, I go to Canada a lot, and it took me several months to work out why. Because a lot of the Middle East reporting that appears in the English language French in Canada is taken from either the New York Times or the London right-wing Daily Telegraph. The French Canadians read newspapers like Le Devoir, which takes from Libération and Le Monde, which are excellent French newspapers, and very good at reporting the Middle East. And you can therefore see quite clearly how the integrity of a newspaper's reporting would increase the judgment and sensitivity of one community that reads it, and the other community, which gets this sort of right-wing pap, is much less aware of what the issues are and much less aware of what the injustices are. There's a very good example of how newspapers do influence the reader.
Absolutely.
You see? And now you don't have this here because you're basically an English language press. And, I mean, I can open the Sydney Morning Herald, et cetera, et cetera, and the reporting of my lectures here, for example, has been pretty fair, that nobody's weighed in. What's sad about the Australian press, for example, and here's a personal example, is that even in book reviews, your newspapers will take syndicated reviews from Britain.
Like your book with you.
Well, Amir Tahari, the Daily Telegraph. Over and over, I get more and more reviews in Australia, and they're all the same review from the Daily Telegraph in London. And I ask myself, you know, don't you have people who can write about the
Middle East? We do, trust me, we do.
Yes, I know, but they don't all write in the newspaper. I mean, you must have a problem here in some ways that American intellectuals have. I mean, it is shameful that one of the most supreme and brilliant linguists and philosophers and political activists in the United States, Noam Chomsky, doesn't even have a regular newspaper column. Yeah. Nor did Edward Said. I mean, every so often he'd been invited, like Chomsky will, to contribute, you know, a special article for a special comment page, just to show that we do show the other point of view.
Same here.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, there you go. And the problem is, you know, newspapers are meant to serve the reader. They don't serve the reader. Not when they report like this. I mean, you had this report in the paper yesterday morning that Brigadier Paul Simon, Australian Commander Middle East, said Al-Qaeda is on the run, that the insurgents are being driven into the ground, that we're winning the war. Now, that is a statement which is palpably untrue. And either Mr. Simon, Brigadier Simon, is not telling the truth or is a very ignorant man. I mean, there's no way around it either way. Iraq is in a state of total anarchy. There are 40,000 insurgents. Americans are dying at a greater rate than ever before. Iraqis are dying at a greater rate than ever before. And Brigadier Simon tells us things are getting better. That is simply not true. But not a single editorial has said, hang on a minute, there's something wrong with this. The only thing the press here did was call up some academic in New South Wales and get him to say, well, it doesn't seem right to me, which is not good enough.
And that person, Hugh White, is a very pro-government person.
Well,
anyway,
exactly,
so.
You see, and here's the problem. Therefore, Simon now speaks with, you know, the John Howard voice. And therefore, after all, the government says it's getting better. Your government's never even said that there were weapons of mass destruction.
One day, maybe.
Well, yes, one
we
day
can
maybe.
Hope.
Don't pull out your hopes. Actually, Blair's never said it with such words. He said, well, there appears to be. You know. They're always waiting to dig out one.
Sort of holding out hope,
they
won't
maybe. Dig out, yes, of course. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, there should have been an editorial in one of your papers saying, hang on a minute, this guy Brigadier Simon is talking through the bottom of his WhatsApp. It's ridiculous. And anyone who's been to Iraq, I mean, Brigadier Simon has to fly around by helicopter. Why doesn't he drive? Because he'd be killed in an ambush, that's why. I don't blame him, but don't tell us it's getting better.
You were talking before about Iraq and how it's becoming increasingly dangerous to travel there, to work there, including for yourself. What's the natural likelihood then of where does the situation go if it becomes too dangerous for someone like you to go, or Patrick Cope or other people to go? What's the inevitable situation then? How do we find out what goes on there if we aren't hearing it from journalists who are actually on the ground there?
We'll keep going. There are ways in. No ways in. We'll keep going.
So your feeling is that despite the dangers, it would take a lot for you not to go, personally?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of my story. I mean, I have never let any part of the Middle East, however dangerous, be outside my ability to go there. I mean, I wouldn't, even in Beirut at the height of the kidnappings, where my friend Terry Anderson was held for almost 7 years, I was still reporting from Beirut. I went into Algeria when hardly any other reporters would go there. Mm. When reporters who did go there were having their throats cut. And I went on reporting, and I travelled on patrols and ambushed and did interviews with FIS members and then later on with GIA people. No, you've got to keep going. I'm not going to allow Iraq to slip away from the Middle East correspondent of the Independent. I won't let that happen. The Americans might not want to go there. The NGOs might be pulled out. The UN isn't there, and the Red Cross may go. But the Independent will maintain a presence there, and I will continue to go because it's my territory, and that's my decision.
And your paper clearly, at this stage, obviously supports what you're doing, and obviously they do support you. But is it
kind of still? The situation of my paper is that as Middle East correspondent, it is my duty to decide whether I go to Iraq. And my editor's view is quite simple. If I say I'm going, then he backs me.
Okay.
And that's a brave thing to do, because if I got kidnapped, it'll be, I don't understand, you know, why you ever let Robert go. He'd have to take a lot of flack.
Yeah.
But he's prepared to, and I'm grateful to that. This is the same guy who prints what I write and doesn't change it. So, of course, I would expect him to do the same. But, you know, I always let him know how grateful I am to him for having his trust in me.
Yeah.
One of the important things, you know, reporters always want to sort of say, well, I have the right to blah, blah, blah. You need strong and tough editors, and you should make friends with editors as a journalist. I do. I always make sure my editor is my friend. I bring him out to the Middle East, and I show him, like, this is what's happening. And, I've been there long enough for my editor to know that I, you know, by and large, I get it right. When I get it wrong, you'll see me on the video screen asking Tony Blair to withdraw British troops from Iraq.
Where do you see yourself in 20 years? Doing the same thing from the same country, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I'll be almost 70 years old in 20 years' time.
Plenty of time? You're still young?
Yeah. I don't think at the age of 70 I'm going to want to jump in the car and race to southern Lebanon every time a shell bursts.
Mm.
But, you know, I tell you, with reporting, some journalists can go on right up to 70 or 80 writing beautifully. Others, and I won't name them because I can think of them, and it's sad because most of them are dead now anyway, there comes a moment when their writing can decline, when it's not because they get burned out, it's not because they became senile, it's just that they've reached the top of their capabilities, and rather than, you know, skate along on the same surface, there is bound to be a diminution. The story becomes the same. We've done this before. You get tired. And I don't want to be in a situation where one day people say, well, Bob Fiske, he used to write very well, didn't he? You know? So I'd like to avoid that. I'd like to make sure that when I'm at the top of my powers and I'm happy and I think I've done as much as I can, maybe I would do something completely different. Screenplay writing for movies.
You said before you're interested in making a film, which is based on something presumably...
I'm very interested in films and the film world, and I go to film festivals, and I'm fascinated by movies and how the enormous, unstoppable power to convince a good film can have, with a political power that you simply can't get in a newspaper article, and not even in a television documentary. I'm not so keen on docs. I'm more interested in feature films.
Mm.
I mean, there's a whole new series of... I mean, Hollywood is crossing the road a bit on the Middle East now. Syriana.
Have you seen Syriana?
Oh, yes, I saw it in the States. And actually, I saw Munich, or Munich, and I thought that was a brilliant film because it took us somewhere we haven't been before. It was a major Hollywood epic, Spielberg, of course, which said that Israel's militarism doesn't work, that they do not have the evidence necessary for assassinating people, and that Mossad could actually be a murderous organization that tries to kill its own agents. Now, that's quite a way across the other side of the road.
Absolutely.
That we've ever been before. Now, other movies, Syriana, yeah, but not a single Arab mentions Israel. In real life, they all would, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Uncle George stayed away. George Clooney stayed away from the Israel. And the same thing happened, remember, in Fahrenheit, 9/11. Not a single mention of Israel.
Right.
It was actually anti-Saudi as well as anti-Bush. It wasn't in any way saying... I mean, of course, I know the Israelis had nothing to do with 9/11, but it didn't sort of say, well, hold on, one of the issues in the Middle East is Israel. He didn't want to touch it. So, but of course, it probably needed a Spielberg to go head on at that. And I know there are, you know, things in the film which aren't accurate, etc., etc. There are other things that are. But in a feature film, you won't get, you know, word-perfect fingerprint accuracy. If you want that, you go into documentaries.
Absolutely. Robert, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Anthony.
Thank you.
Take care.
How cool was that, man?
That was pretty amazing, John. Wow.
the insights that he has, and you know, we've talked at great length about taking control of language and all the stuff that he speaks about, you know, the difference between a wall and a fence, and, you know, and there's stuff in the lecture about Palestinians die in struggles while Israelis, or clashes, that's right, in clashes, while Israelis die in attacks and bombings and the like. And there's a very considered effort where journalists are actually censored to use those terms. It's insane.
Even trying to approach this with the depth that Robert just approached it, to me, there's no way I could do what he just did.
Oh, I know. Well, and I'll tell you, everybody should go to the Information Clearinghouse, and we'll have the links up after the show. I just never seem to have enough time to get that whole thing together before we go on air. There's always something that, you know. But anyway, the Information Clearinghouse has a copy of Robert's newest entry at the Independent, and a lot of it revolves around the efforts to censor Antony Lowenstein himself with his book project. I mean, there's been a lot of really, really amazing attempts to censor a much more clear and, you know, I don't know, less emotionally biased kind of thing on the state of Israel and Palestine.
Well,
and that's bizarre to me.
He is going to have, it's going to be an excellent lecture. I can hardly wait to listen to this later on tonight. This is going to be pretty amazing. So,
and the question time, which is about, you know, one third of it maybe, is just outstanding. And we, one of the Muslim leaders here in New South Wales who played such a great role in bringing the fire down after the riots here, who really, really stepped up, and many of the Muslim leaders here just did an outstanding job to just step up and say, look, whatever happens, there will be no retaliation, and, you know, got the mothers involved and all that. And he poses I believe his name is Karzai. Karzatran, I believe his name is. But anyway, he poses a really, really interesting question about the a line being drawn, and can even Robert Fisk see that line? And, you know, I just can't. I'm still absorbing everything that I took in on the night, because, you know, I was also monitoring the actual record while people are looking at me in the satellite room thinking I'm actually responsible for the volume they hear, but I have nothing to do with it, and they're all hollering at me to turn things up. It almost got ugly for a second, but and it was just like, I got to make a little sign that says, this event being recorded for Fourth Estate Radio, and stick it right in front of my remote mixer so that people just go away. There was a little bit of explaining afterwards, but like I said, it was like a rock and roll atmosphere. This is the thing that really, really struck everybody, you know. And you know, Gail and I come both from production backgrounds, and we're just looking around going, you know, I haven't seen this much energy with a group of people, and you're going to a spoken word thing. We're going to go see a journalist, and you should have seen him just the way he threw his energy around. You can get a complete feel for it from just the audio. It's just amazing. And I have heard that the video of it will be available at some point, and I will make sure that those links are available. So, and it's about 28.
Woke up this morning, I suddenly realized we're all in this together. I started smiling, 'cause you were smiling, and we're all in this together. I'm made of atoms, you're made of atoms, and we're all in this together. And long division.
It's the Cup of Joe Report. I'm Joe Vecchio. More and more polls are coming out showing how unpopular Mr. Bush is. He's hovering at just below 40% nationally, which is about as bad as any president can get that hasn't, say, killed someone in cold blood on national television. Though I'm sure Fox News has a special planned. Maybe Bush can execute one of the prisoners from Abu Ghraib personally, just like that guy in Eddie Adams' Pulitzer Prize-winning picture from Vietnam. Hey, the executioner was on our side, after all. Just like Saddam before he fell out of favor. Bush can even put on some kind of uniform for the occasion. He likes uniforms. Bill Clinton's poll numbers were up around the 60% area when the Republicans tried to kick him out of office for lying about a blowjob. They didn't give a damn about the polls any more then than they do now. Why should they have to? Their cult members will believe anything they tell them, and since so many of their districts, or should I say asylums, are gerrymandered just for them, they have no worries about getting reelected. And if all else fails, there's always Diebold. Don't get me wrong. I'm glad to know that the majority of the country is unhappy with Bush and the Republicans. Most Americans really do agree with liberal policies, at least they do when they find out they're being taken away.
Live where you want to live, and you know. And this kind of ties in both of those situations, John, I think. And that is that apparently the top chaplain for the Nation was prepared to leave this week. Official speech last year and with terrorists in the world.
Wow.
Umar Abdul Jalil, I'm sorry, director of the city jail's ministerial services unit and a well-known imam of a Harlem mosque, is prohibited from having contact with inmates pending a review of his comments. You dig that, man?
Hey, man, you know what happened to, you know, the land of free speech? I swear it's you know, you're getting to the point of thought crimes. So the guy has an opinion. It happens to be an opinion that a lot of people are beginning to share, and within the United States. So, I mean, this is where, with other things that are going on, you see this kind of thing, and it's scary. It's very, very scary, man.
Apparently, and this is just to give you some background on this, in an April speech to a group of Islamic leaders in Tucson, Abdul Jalil, allegedly said that Jews controlled the media and that Muslims were being tortured in Manhattan jails. The speech was taped by something called the Investigative Project, a counterterrorism organization. And at one point, Abdul Jalil urged American Muslims to stop allowing the Zionists of the media to dictate what Islam is to us.
The pretty fiery statements, man. But, you know, still, the guy, they don't have anything that he incited anything. He's just purely stated a pretty extreme opinion, as from what I can see. I'm scanning the article as well. Do they have anything else on him that he's done? Has he done, you know?
Not really. No, not really. And actually, this is not unheard of, though, in New York. Because apparently the city fire department forced its Muslim chaplain to resign after he publicly expressed doubt that Al-Qaeda hijackers had brought down the World Trade Center. So, you know, So there that is. I mean, you know, apparently free speech is okay as long as you're not Muslim.
Well, so. Yeah, free speech as long as you don't say too much.
Well, you know, and I seriously doubt that had a Jewish rabbi said that that Muslims were murderers and, you know, or said anything very, or the Muslims of the media dictate what Judaism is to them. I seriously doubt that that person would get fired. Do you think they would get fired, John?
Pat Robertson. Sorry. Sorry, did that come out loud? Yes, I agree.
It sounded like a thinly disguised cough, but yes, Pat Robertson came out.
Sorry, I was remembering movies. But man, we have a caller, actually, not to divert too much, but we have a caller. We have Luke from Knoxville on line one and has something about Howard Dean he wants to talk to us about. You there, Luke?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi guys. I was telling Bob. One of the things I was reading this morning was over at Daily Kos. There's an article about Howard Dean talking about his 50-state strategy. You know, where some of the bigwigs in the party are trying to tell him, you know, you need to be concentrating on these certain states, and he's like, no, we need to be concentrating on every state.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw him speak here last year, and he was already kind of starting that whole attack kind of thing, where he was saying, you know, we have to go and run for dog catcher and take back from local councils and everything out. if we want to take, you know, there was too much of this focusing on swing states, and a lot of core Democratic states the last time around foregoing voting machines and everything felt robbed. Absolutely, man.
Well, it's one of those things where I was telling Bob, he's been talking about, you know, with his thing with, my mind's going blank on me a minute. It's the senator there. where it's one of those things where, you know, if you've got a conservative, moderate conservative, whatever you want to say, and a liberal Democrat both going for the same primary, even though maybe the moderate one's going to be way ahead and you know he's going to win, we still need to go out and vote in the primary for the liberal just so they know we're still alive.
Absolutely.
You know, just so it's like, guys, it ain't just the conservatives that are funded, that are pushing you for the moderates. There's still, there's still a Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And you got to pay
attention to what we say, too. I agree with that, and I actually think that all opposition parties worldwide at the moment in all Western governments are facing a moment where they're actually having to do that thing of reclaiming what the party is supposed to be about, and, you know, getting rid of the DLC Democrats in the United States is one of the things that needs to happen.
Well,
you know, decide whether...
Well, it's like Bob was saying the thing about Senator Byrd, said, you know, Senator Byrd, I don't think even has any competition. He said what we got to do, though, is if you've got somebody like that who's really, you know, ticked you off, you know what I mean, we still have to go vote because we have to vote all the other things. But said, on some of these people like that, you know, but if every other one of us didn't vote in the primary, would they still get in, you know, still be up for the general election?
I agree with you too, but I remember listening, I think it was Tom Hartman was talking about, in situations where you have a really, you know, a Democrat that we might not necessarily think is a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
In the primaries, if you have a good progressive candidate that you can run against him to put some, even if the more progressive one doesn't actually win the nomination,
still fighting.
And it can put some pressure on to the more set candidates that, you know, hey, man, you got to start actually acting like a Democrat if you want the nomination.
Well, you know, it's these things we've had going on lately. It's like most of these DLC Democrats are like, well, we don't even need, you know, if we're going to lose, so why should we even fight? It's like, that's the ones you got to be fighting the hardest on. You're still going to lose, but let them know you're there. I mean, you know, some of these things, it's like they think, well, we're going to lose, so let's just not even play. It's like, no, you go up there and you show them that you're not going to give up, that you're still going to be in there swinging.
Well, I'll tell you what, we just had a really, really good swinging match down here in Australia this week because Beasley, our Labor leader, I think is a big, fat backstabber as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, we've got those in the Democratic Party in the United States. You know, Joe Lieberman to me is a classic example. And Simon Crean, who was his seat was up for election this past week, and because he went for someone else for the leadership in the last election, since he backed Latham, Beasley wouldn't go out and support this guy. And this guy actually is a really, really, really good Labor guy. He's a little, some people think he's a little sly, but I don't know. His record shows him to be something. He actually, with no support from the party leader, had a mad victory, almost 70% of the vote. And it's now bringing up some discussion about maybe it's time to recapture the Labor Party here with real Labor Party people.
Well, you know, it's like some people have said that, one thing that maybe catch the party is if everybody just gave directly to the candidate, quit giving it to the party to go through to give to the candidate, because the party's not paying attention to where we want it to go. A lot of this stuff
Absolutely.
Is go ahead and make the donation straight to the person and forget about going through the party.
Well, Luke, I totally agree because we go ahead, Bruce.
If I may get in a second here, Luke. One of the things that I think that is different between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. If you look at the close relationship
leadership, the president,
it's hard for me to say that. It's not for any other reason than I hate to say his name. But President Bush, the relationship that he has with Ken Mellman, who is the Republican chairman, and how closely together the National Republican Party works with the White House and the leadership there. There's the difference is that with the Democratic Party, Howard Dean and Senator and Senator Reid and what's the Nancy Pelosi? They don't seem to work as cohesively together, so that there's different messages that each one of them put out, and there doesn't really seem to be a nationally coordinated campaign on the left-hand side of the spectrum. Now I also realize that, you know, as what's his name? I'm thinking of the guy. Anyway, he said something along the lines of, you know, I'm not a member of any organized party. I'm a Democrat. I understand that. But I also think that in order for us to create the kind of change that we need, Will Rogers, that's right. Thank you, Bob. You know, to create the kind of change that we need on our side of the political spectrum, we have to create some cohesiveness, mm-hmm. you know. Because it, you know, and that's a call to arms to Democratic campaigners, you know, is to work together to try to create a national consensus. And John, I'll cede the floor to you, my friend.
All I was going to ask though is it a two pronged thing though, where Howard Dean is saying, you know, it's the complete 50 states thing, which I think is relocalizing the party to the members. Well, in my opinion, go ahead.
Well, it's like I think I've told you this before. I said, from what I understand from Howard Dean, it's like, say, he's believing in working from the bottom up. You know, it's like the people up at the top, they can take care of themselves. They've got the corporate donors and all that. It's like we're on the ground. We've got to be pushing the people, like, say, from the state house up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They're wanting us to pay all the money to the people at the Senate and the House and work sort of, like, say, trickle down. It's like, no, that does not work.
No doubt. And I think that's because it was what was it called in the Reagan era, the kitchen cabinets that did all that work behind the scenes very, very quietly and very, very effectively. I mean, you got to give credit where credit's due, man. But
can I bring
up
one other subject if you don't mind?
Please do.
Well, you were speech there that you were playing a little bit ago, talking about, you know, U.S. media versus the world media, so to speak.
Yes.
The one that always reminds me of this is when you go back to when they first went into Baghdad and they had what they called the statue pull down.
Oh, man.
I still remember that because if you looked at the U.S. media, you would have sworn there was 100,000 people in that park, and they were all there cheering and screaming until I saw the BBC coverage.
Yes.
It was a TV show. I mean, they had
you
reflectors,
bet.
Everything set up, so it was a TV set.
I well, mean, you know that actually... CNN U.S. and CNN International had two completely different versions of the story that they were airing at the same time. And over here, we were getting Fox News and CNN International, and the Fox News was basically the same as the CNN American version. That was, you know, it made it look like, you know, it was this homegrown thing when half of them were people that worked for American contractors.
Well, they were showing the thing, and BBC showed the thing from pulled way back on the other side, essentially of this park or whatever it is. And I mean, they didn't take up a tenth of the space. I mean, it was a little corner of this park over there, and it was set up like you'd have sworn they were shooting a movie. I mean, had reflectors and the cameras on cranes and the whole nine yards.
Oh yeah, not only that. I watched really closely because it reminded me of the camera techniques that they use in Australian football coverage. That if the seats aren't full, they're very, very coy about the way that they crop all the shots.
Yeah.
And the cameramen are great, so that the only time you ever see crowd is when they're able to make it look like it's full in the entire spectrum that you see. And I was watching the way that they were tracking that thing on the two different sets of coverage, and it was just dramatic.
Well, you know, it's like the thing when they had the when Bush was on the aircraft carrier. It wasn't an amazing note. If you read the print journalist, they would tell you, oh, by the way, if we turned around, we could see the San Diego skyline. But not one
right.
TV channel, not one TV network would turn a camera around to look.
And if you actually looked at the coverage, you would think that he was in the Persian Gulf somewhere.
As far out as he could be. Oh, I just saw something on TV I thought you might want to just be interested in. Tomorrow night on C-SPAN, they have their Q&A series or what this thing now that I think is what Brian's doing now instead of book notes pretty much. Tomorrow night is Mr. Keith Olbermann.
Oh. Ooh, nice.
That should be interesting.
What time will that be?
It's 8 o'clock Eastern, it said.
Excellent, excellent.
But
He and O'Reilly have been going toe-to-toe as of late, from what I understand. Oh, I haven't been able to catch up on the footage.
If you go to, like, Crooks and Liars, they've got some of the things you can put in, like, they've got their archive section you can search by name, like, just put in Oberman's name, and you can go back and see these for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and they are hilarious.
He's good, man. Hey, man, thanks so much for ringing. Right. We're just coming up on a break, man. Thank you so much, and ring us anytime.
Bye.
Thanks, Luke.
Hey, man, that he's such a great caller. He's just got his stuff together, you know. And as usual, before we come up on music, which is coming any second, we're blogging at fourthestateradio.com, chatting at the Tom Hartman chat room, and streaming and archiving at the White Rose Society. Take us out, Bruce.
You just did. This is Bruce Birch.
Right,
that's John Fox. This is 4th Estate Radio. We'll be back very shortly. Hey, this is Bruce Birch, and here's one of my recent rants on George Bush. He's living an opposite world. It's like everything that he says, it's just completely the opposite to reality. Okay, he says that the low level of public support for his policies in Iraq showed that the public had been distracted from achievements made in that country by images of violence on the news. So he's blaming the news. He's blaming the news for reporting the freaking truth. Rather than his propaganda, which he likes to catapult. All right. Well, I just wanted to deviate from the Alito stuff because I think it's pretty important to remember how stupid the president is. You know, because you know we need to know how stupid he is, right?
And so, in my speech to the nation, whatever you want to call it, speech to the nation. I asked Americans to give 4,000 hours over the next, or the rest of your life, of service to America. That's what I asked. I said, 4,000 hours.
Join me, Bruce Birch, every Sunday evening, 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, as we point out the stupidity of the Bush regime. AllThingsReconsidered.org.
Hi, this is Guy James. Remember me? As many of you know, I got the boot from the radio stations that carried my show a while back because I got a little too controversial for them to handle. Well, I'm back now, but I'll be doing my show 5 days a week from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time starting on March 20th. You can join us at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org. And if you like hard-hitting, thought-provoking, entertaining radio, then join us starting March 20th at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org for the new Guy James Show.
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Who is gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
Hi, my name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about a place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
It's not available now.
Nope, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
I'm glad you brought that up, Jim.
Right on. Welcome back. Bruce Birch, please take it away.
Thank you, John. Yeah, you listen to For the State Radio. This is Bruce Birch. And I am, this is our Occupation Watch segment. John, you still with me?
Yes, man, I'm here. I'm here. I'm here.
Sorry about that. I just had a technical difficulty there for one moment. I do want to go ahead and bring you the latest, the human cost of the occupation in Iraq, which is what I do at every Occupation Watch segment. And according to anti-war.com/casualties, the actual American deaths to date are 2,307. And since the president flew onto the ship, codpiece included, that's 2,170. I say that every show, and I love saying that every show, by the way. 2,170 people have died. And then also on the on the Iraqi side, actually, I've heard a different, John, I've heard a different estimate today that actually puts the number up around 250,000.
Really? Where did that? Who came up with that one?
That was out of informationclearinghouse.info, and there was a couple of Iraqi-based media persons that were estimating that. But
wow.
That's on the high side. I'd say on the low side, anywhere from 130 to 135,000. So.
There's an Iraqi-based media that's not U.S. controlled.
That, you know what? They might be just popping right up over there, buddy.
Well, man, that'd be a good thing.
I think so. I think they need a Fourth Estate Radio over there, don't you?
Oh, I tell you, man, if we could find some, you know, Iraqi blogger that has a sound card and a microphone and a set of headphones, I'd love to have that on this. Oh, I'd love to have him on the network. That would just be incredible.
That'd be fantastic. Let's dig one up.
Yeah, anybody out there who's Yeah, it's an open call, you know. Time for the Baghdad Report on the Head On Radio Network, you know.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely it is. Well, you know, this is the story for this week, and this is coming out of Washington, that a former top CIA official said this past week that despite the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, Iraq is likely to be looking for weapons of mass destruction within the next 5 to 10 years. 5 to 10 years, okay? Paul Pillar, who until last year was in charge of intelligence assessments for the Middle East, said that the CIA warned the Bush administration before the Iraq invasion in 2003 that a change of regimes would not necessarily solve any WMD problem. In a speech at the Middle East Institute here in Washington, Pillar said Iraqis live in a dangerous neighborhood with rival countries pursuing weapons of mass destruction. So the CIA had warned that a future Iraqi government would likely want the very weapons Hussein was wrongly suspected of hiding, including nuclear weapons. Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, I'm with you there, man, but, you know, and in a way, should we be surprised that now the place is in basically chaos? Because you listen to any media outside the U.S. media, you know, it's civil war over there. The word is being used, but yet the mainstream media seems to not be able to say it out loud. So, yeah, you know,
who is a Middle East intelligence expert. Says in the speech, he also said that Iraq is now serving the same purpose that Afghanistan once did, as an inspiration and a base for radical Islam. You know,
they've created this absolute, you know, just I don't know, it's a melting pot of anger and resentment. You know, there's a bit in the lecture that everybody gets to hear later, where in the film footage he's walking through a mosque that's just been bombed, and this is in the 80s at some point, or I think, and he kind of looks up and he says, listen to what I say in the voiceover here. He says something to the effect of, you know, with the indiscriminate bombing that would just happen to these mosques, and he showed how it was portrayed on the U.S. media back during the days of Reagan and whatnot, and he just say, what do the Muslims have in store for us? And, I mean, how have we provoked this with a sick foreign policy that's misguided by lies? It's just insane.
Well, it is. And, you know, and as one of our friends in the chat room points out that, you know, if you're a country living close to Israel... Oh, my goodness. You know, and actually, you know, it's you know, I don't want to laugh too much about it, just because the reality is that, you know, with the situation with Iran, that Israel recently also, you know, came out and said, bottom line is that if the UN or the U.S. doesn't act, they will. So
now that's scary.
It's heating up over there, my friend. It's well, going to be a bonfire, you know.
What is it? Every story that we don't seem to have the right discussion about is getting ready to blow up in our face, man. It's insane. Well, you know, we're up at the end of the hour here, man. So we got news break coming up, I believe, with our man Bob Kincaid. It's coming up on 2 minutes before the hour. I'm John Fox. He's Bruce Birch. We'll be back in a bit.
McGruff, the crime dog, here with my nephew Scruff. Get a pencil and write down an important address. It's for the new McGruff comic activity book.
And it's full of me.
The address is...
Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
Hey, Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652. Scruff McGruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
It tells you what to do about guns and about bullies and drugs and about strangers who want to give you a ride.
Scruff, scruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
And it's full of games and puzzles, too. So for your free copy of my new comic activity book, just write...
Scruff, scruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
Not bad.
Can I do it again?
One more time.
Scruff, scruff, Chicago, Illinois, 60652.
You'll be helping me take a bite out of crime.
Planet Check.
He's the granola Ayatollah of canola. Charles Ford, founder of Grasoline Solutions, explains.
I just started writing rhymes while I was farming and doing the eco thing, so that's kind of how this all came about.
Ford spits the truth.
Now, Rudolph Diesel was no weasel, this we know to be true. He was an engineer and a humanitarian, too. He made it possible for us to drive on vegetable fuel. Nobody told you that, well, that's what I'm trying to do. It was back around the turn of last century when Dr. Diesel offered up this opportunity. Corn, soy, chicken, fat, some flour, flax, hemp, seed. Farmers could grow their own fuel, not only their feed. Small towns could be self-sufficient about their energy needs without drilling or spilling or paying a fee. It's like that.
Biodiesel reduces cancer-causing emissions by 75%. For more eco-wrap and all the 411 on biodiesel,
Grasoline.com. Check us out.
That's Planet Check.
Planet Check is possible thanks to Clif Bar, the energy bar made with organic ingredients by a company committed to sustaining you and the planet. More at CliffBar.com.
Head-on radio news. I'm Bob Kincaid. Yugoslavian war criminal Slobodan Milosevic is dead. In a scene reminiscent of the end of Hermann Göring, Milosevic was found dead in his cell at The Hague on Saturday. No cause of death has been established. The United Nations is investigating. Milosevic was standing trial for crimes against humanity stemming from the bloody Balkan Civil War that followed the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. The butcher from Belgrade, as he was known, was 64 years old. Speaking of butchers, on Saturday, George Bush celebrated the third anniversary of the war he started against the people of Iraq. In his weekly radio address, Bush cited yet another reason for attacking the defenseless nation.
Under Saddam Hussein, Iraq was an enemy of America who shot at airplanes.
Bush said Saturday that the greatest threat to American troops in Iraq comes from ordinary household appliances.
IEDs are homemade bombs that can be hidden in cars or by the side of a road and detonated remotely using everyday devices like garage door openers and cordless phones. These weapons are now the principal threat to our troops and to the future of a free Iraq.
This week will mark the third anniversary of Bush's having told the world that he had lost his patience with Iraq. Another member of the Bush administration may be headed for prison. Claude Allen was Bush's number one domestic policy advisor until he quit unexpectedly last week. Now we know why. Allen, a fundamentalist Christian, was indicted in Maryland for bilking department stores out of about $5,000 in a refund bunco scam. The conservative ran his con more than 25 times against Hex and Target stores. Allen made $161,000 a year in the White House. He was one of the Bush administration nominees for the federal appeals court, who was blocked by Democrats a couple of years ago. Allen, beloved by the religious right, is facing as many as 15 years in the penitentiary. The headless bodies of two policemen were found in Afghanistan Saturday. The two had been reported missing a day earlier in Helmand Province, a remote desert area in the southern part of the country, after being abducted from their homes. Only 2 weeks ago, George Bush used his radio address to tout the tremendous success he has had bringing peace and freedom to the blasted, poverty-stricken nation. Spain marked the second anniversary of the Madrid train bombings Saturday. Two schoolchildren laid a wreath at the Spanish Forest of Remembrance as Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero and a host of Spanish citizens looked on. After getting out of Iraq, Spain has caught and brought to justice several dozen of those responsible for the bombings. George Bush's administration has neither caught nor killed the mastermind of September 11th. The FBI wants you to be afraid. The agency is warning people that they might be blown to pieces if they go to college basketball games. This is News on the Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.
Hey, have you got a minute? I'm going to say a word. You tell me what comes to mind. Are you ready?
Okay.
Tchaikovsky.
Gesundheit. Okay, what's the word?
No, see, that is the word. What does Tchaikovsky make you think of?
I don't know. Allergy season?
Hey there, how you doing?
What's up?
Who's Martha Graham?
She invented the Graham cracker.
No kidding.
Yeah, before her there was only soda crackers.
Hard to imagine. Hey, young lady.
Yeah?
Does the name Man Ray mean anything to you?
Duh. The Man Ray is a kind of poisonous jellyfish, and it lives in the Gulf of Mexico.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's very deadly.
Are your kids as well-rounded as they could be? Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more about the value of arts education, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music, Martha Graham's dance, and Man Ray's photography. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
Jordan has shown itself more capable than the Bush administration in catching and punishing terrorists. The Jordanian government executed two men Saturday who were convicted of the murder of Lawrence Foley, an American diplomat. Foley was slain in 2002 as he walked to his car outside his residence in Amman, Jordan. The body of an American peace activist has been found in Iraq. The State Department announced Friday night after the close of the weekly news cycle that it believed a body found near Baghdad was that of American Tom Fox. Preliminary reports say Fox was bound hand and foot and shot in the head. Fox was abducted November 26th, along with three other Christian peace activists. He did not appear in a video released last week by the kidnappers that was aired on Al Jazeera. Tensions continue to mount between Afghanistan and Pakistan. After blasting Hamid Karzai last week on U.S. television, Pakistani dictator Pervez Musharraf's forces killed 26 people Saturday in clashes along the mountainous border with Afghanistan. Pakistan used helicopter gunships provided by the United States to attack the peasant villages with rockets and machine gun fire. Iran made it clear Saturday that it is willing to use oil as a weapon if the U.S. continues to push the United Nations towards sanctions against it over its nuclear program. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice continues to reject attempts to negotiate an accord. Another South American country is continuing the trend toward the left and away from the Bush administration. Joyous celebrations took place in Valparaiso, Chile, Saturday, as that country inaugurated its first female president. Michelle Bachelet took office amid parades, fiestas, and a general feeling of goodwill. A who's who of left-leaning leaders from South America took part in the events, including the presidents of Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, and Venezuela. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, a former coca farmer, gave Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice a guitar decorated with coca leaves. Sadly, George Bush did not attend. For the Head-On Radio News Network, I'm Bob Kincaid.
Thank you.
everybody. Welcome back to Hour 3 of Fourth Estate Radio. My name is John Fox in Sydney, Australia. We're blogging at Fourth Estate Radio, chatting at fourthestateradio.com, chatting at the Tom Hartman chat room, and Bruce Birch is up on the north side.
Yes, I am, John, and I was listening to the news there, and, you know, we've been doing so much other stuff in the middle of all this. It's a, you know, the third hour news is the only newscast that I actually listened to because I was in the middle of doing about 18 other different things.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but it just blows my mind that garage door openers are now being used as improvised explosive devices, IEDs. I'm thinking now that my DVD remote could be suspect. I mean, I might get hauled in. You know?
Well, I tell you, it's just given me another reason that I'm really, really glad that I don't have a car. You know, I don't need to worry about the garage door opener at all. I mean, that just sounds so stupid. I mean,
Iraqis with garage door openers are now suspected of... What in the hell is he talking about?
I mean, you know, please. Just please. It's like plastic wrap and duct tape or whatever the hell it was. Cellophane and duct tape, you know?
So if I see a Middle Eastern guy walking down the road with a blender, I should be worried? Is that what he's trying to tell me?
Oh, no, he might want to make you a daiquiri.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God, a drive-by drinking.
It better be a virgin.
I'm sorry. It just we're seriously getting past the point of insanity here, Bruce. You know, the clip last week. I had to ask whether that was someone doing a parody of Bush or not when it came to the mango thing, which is where the drive-by daiquiri thing came from. But
that's it. John, that's it right there. The deal is he's going to be sending the nukes for mangoes, and then we're going to have the appliances coming here, and together it's going to be like, you remember how they used to do that that commercial with the chocolate and the peanut butter crashing together to making the M&M's thing?
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, wasn't
Reese's,
it?
Yeah, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, exactly. So that's what's going to happen. We should do, okay, anyway. stream of consciousness there. Speaking of Republican idiocy,
yes.
There's a gentleman here locally that he is completely out of his he blows my mind. And actually, before I do anything else, I want you to listen to this radio ad, and I'm not even going to tell you who it is. Bob, if you want to go ahead and run the first clip, go ahead and shock us.
This lesson in tough love paid for by Vernon Robinson for Congress. Bill Cosby made the liberals mad when he said black hoodlums need to stop stealing and start getting jobs. That black mothers need to stop having 8 babies by 7 different fathers. Stop talking street talk jive like, yo dog, peep my bling bling.
You can't be a doctor with that kind of coming out of your mouth. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where you is. Go wild.
As a congressman, Vernon Robinson will tell all of America what he tells his own 3 children. Stay in school, speak English, and get a job. Don't have children out of wedlock, don't take drugs, don't commit crime, and if you do, don't pull a Jesse Jackson and blame it on Whitey.
I am Vernon Robinson, and I approve this message because Bill Cosby was right. The biggest problem facing blacks today isn't slavery or racism, it's the destruction of the family. The answer isn't racial quotas or a government handout, it's personal responsibility.
Oh, my God.
What do you think about that, John?
Well, can I tell you my own memory about Bill Cosby back in the 80s? And I think this interestingly applies.
Please do.
When I was a young man of, I guess, 20 years old or something like that and going to school in New York, I was working at a big liquor and wine store, and I remember hearing this ad. It was during the height of the Cosby Show days, you know, like probably about 2/3 of the way through that run. And they were advertising for an open casting call for, they were looking to get more kids for Friends of the Cosby Kids, right? And there was this really weird wording to the thing saying, looking for something like, you know, and I'm paraphrasing from many, many moons ago, Hispanics, Asians, African Americans, blah, 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 honkies need not apply. And from that day forward, I always just felt like Bill Cosby, no matter his genius and how much I love him, he, like, to me, must be a disappointment to his fellow African Americans, as far as I think.
Well, and actually, you know, Michael Eric Dyson, who is one of the leading intellectuals in the African American community, is very much down on him, as is Cornel West. You know, so Cosby isn't exactly the poster person for African American, for the African American success, I guess, story. But that gentleman we just heard was Vernon Robinson, and Vernon Robinson is actually running for Congress as a Republican, and he's an African American guy. And
that
he has got to be one of the strangest people I have ever heard of in my life. It just amazes me. But we do have a call. John, you want to field that?
Okay. I do believe our good friend Peter from Tallahassee is on line one. G'day, Peter. Welcome to Fourth Estate Radio.
Hey, John Fox. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing wonderful, man, and doing better hearing your voice. What brings you to the show this week?
Well, I'm just wondering about what the problem is here. If the problem is eight babies by seven different fathers, okay, what if it's eight babies by a single father and you're married to them? And the problem is that the local pharmacist won't fill your birth control. I mean, there's no end to the hypocrisy in this, and it just ties directly into the Cadillac welfare BS that we've been hearing for so long. Blame the poor people, and you know, everybody's got to have a victim. I can't believe it. And I was wondering.
Yeah, and yet.
Go ahead.
Juxtapose that against the corporate just cronyism and the looting of the treasury that goes on there. That even if there were a couple of people, you know, this small minority of the population that was getting away somehow with murder on welfare somehow, but I just don't see it.
Well,
you know,
it's
nothing in comparison, but, you know, I just think it's a joke.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know, that could be...
What's his name?
I never kiss and tell. But, but, I mean, he could be dangerous. I mean, you know, that remote, I use it all the time. And, you know, the man is totally incompetent, totally incompetent. But, you know, the really reason I called is this news article that Bob has been reading when he's been reading the news about this Claude Allen guy. And I had read that earlier today, and, you know, that just really ticks me off. You know, this guy has swindled department stores out of better than $5,000 over the last year doing this refund scheme. Now, during the time he was doing that, he was still employed as Bush's domestic policy advisor. And, he was observed in these stores on more than 25 occasions. What he would do is buy the item, take them to his car, then walk back into the store with the receipt, pick up the same items, and go to customer service and get a refund, as if that was the receipt that went with the items he just picked up in the store. Now, he's been observed doing that. And what amazes me is that the neighbors and the members of his church have expressed confidence that he would be exonerated. When will these people catch on? Do they not have any clue? My God, if there were a fundraiser to buy these people a clue, I would contribute.
the first thing that just gobsmacks me here, guys, is just the fact that this is an adult male that did this. It sounds like something a scam that a teenager would do.
Well, it
you
does.
Know, I mean,
there are two types of people that would pull that scam. There's two types. Anyone, Republican, Democrat, black or white, that's strung out on drugs. I know,
right.
Been there, done that. And the other type, if you're not strung out on drugs, is a Republican. Basically, those are the only two groups that do it. You know, it just boggles the mind. The Reverend Joshua Harris of the Covenant Life Church in Gaithersburg, Maryland, said, I think if we let the whole situation clear, the truth is going to come out in time. You know,
he's absolutely right. The truth will come out. The problem is that the truth isn't going to be something he's going to want to hear.
No, the level of denial. I mean, they're so far up the river denial that, you know, they will never be able to paddle back. It just blows me away. I just think the whole story is outrageous. And then on top of that, when he was arrested, Allen called the legal staff of the White House and told them that, you know, he had been arrested, but he lied. He told them that there had been a screw up on his credit card and it would be resolved, and it was just something about his credit card was issued incorrectly or some story, whatever. So first thing he does after he gets busted is not admit to anyone that he's done wrong. It's the same thing who is the guy the one that just got busted and sent to prison for 8 years, Cunningham? He pulled the same thing. He was in total denial. These people will never admit to anything until they're right on the TV lights and, you know, they've been convicted. Such dishonesty. And those are the people that are running the place.
Yeah. And those are the people that are running the place.
Yeah, running America. And, you know, Allen started his career working for Jesse Helms, too. That's, you know, he's got a long history steeped in Republican values, you know. Just amazes me.
It is
insane.
It's absolutely repugnant, isn't it?
Yes, it's amazing. And, you know, other than that story just outraged me. But, you know, the show has been excellent tonight. I really, really enjoyed the interview that you did with the woman regarding Lord, I can't call the site now. You can probably call it better. Subversive Southerners, the official for Ann Braden. Now, that was remarkable. I was so glad to hear that voice and those thoughts. That was really great. I just really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Peter. That was kind of put together at the last minute, and Kate came on and did a fantastic job, and we're going to keep in touch with her. I think she's probably a lady we may want to come back to later on and touch base with. You know, she
Excellent.
Seems to have a real
Give her a
command
show,
on
man. Give her a
history.
Show.
I hear you.
Okay.
Right on, Peter. Well, thanks for ringing in. I do believe we have a couple of other calls waiting, so we'll talk to you in the coming weeks, matey.
Perfect. Take care. Good night.
All right. Good night, mate. Who do we have lined up there, Bob? Throw somebody on. Surprise.
We have Arbor Tender on line two. How are you doing, Arbor Tender?
Hey, I'm good. How are you guys tonight?
We're doing fantastic, but we'll get better.
Oh, man. Fantastic. I love to hear that. Yeah, things are getting better out here, too. There's been some interesting developments in California with the congressional races.
Okay.
And I don't know if you guys are following this stuff or not, but well, for one thing, I can tell you that in my district, Hilda Solis is running, and she's got a couple of Democratic contenders for her seat, which doesn't happen that often, and a Republican contender for her seat. But the more interesting race is the 24th district, which is, that would be Gallegly's district. And one of our fellow bloggers and visitors to the Tom Hartman chat room is, you know, Steady.
Sure.
Michael Stettler. And could you hang on just for 1 second? Okay. So anyway, so Michael Stettler has been, running. And anyway, the deal with Gallegly is he suddenly, after a 20-year incumbency in this seat, has withdrawn from the race.
Wow.
At the very last minute, before the filing period was scheduled to be over at 5 o'clock yesterday. And so anyway, Gallegly withdrew. This other cat has stood up from the wings, which nobody's ever heard of, a fellow by the name of Tannenbaum. There's another Democratic contender, Jill Martinez, who has gotten on the ballot, and Steady failed to qualify. However, because Gallegly has, if I understand it correctly, because Representative Gallegly has withdrawn from the race, medical reasons, he stated, it looks as though that what they're going to do is reopen the candidacy, the filing period, for 5 days, which is California state election law. If the incumbent does not file by the deadline, which is kind of weird because he did actually file, but he's withdrawing his nomination. If the incumbent doesn't file by the deadline, then the deadline is automatically extended for 5 days for everyone but the incumbent to throw down. So even though, because as everybody probably knows, Michael Stettler got in the race a little bit late. He became inspired here just a couple of months ago to participate in this campaign and to try to take a Republican district back for the Democrats. And so apparently he's going to get another shot at it. He didn't have enough signatures. He was really last minute, getting in, but really enthusiastic and really I think he's going to make a fine congressman. And it looks as though a door has opened so that he's actually going to have an opportunity to file as not as a write-in candidate, but as a ballot candidate in the primary in June. And so we don't know the answer yet, but because of this trick that Gallagher has played at the last minute, it looks as though there's going to be a court decision on Monday morning that's going to open the door for another 5 days so that this guy Tannenbaum can get his foot on the door and the Republicans don't lose the district entirely. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. I do have a question for you, though.
Okay,
how
I'll
many,
try.
How close did Michael Stettler come with his signatures?
Oh, he is within one signature of the minimum.
Within one signature?
Of the minimum. You have to gather between 40 and 60 signatures. And he has 39 signatures. As of the moment of truth, he had 39 signatures and was standing in the Ventura County elections office there, the registrar's office, which is I think in Oxnard. He was standing in the elections office looking for another signature so he could get his thing in there at the last minute. And
wow.
But see, and it looks, see, it's funny how things look black and then they look absolutely brilliant. Then 2 hours later, he's moping, you know, because he ran. I'm telling you, he ran for the money, and it wasn't looking good. And then suddenly, Mr. Gallagher made his announcement last night, and it got out on the. It's all over the world now. If you Google Gallagher, you'll find it's going to be a huge race. It's going to be a really huge race. It's enormous that Gallagher has stepped down, and so there's going to be this open field.
Yeah, I think that's pretty amazing. And if you're in touch with Mr. Stettler, please let him know that that John and I are hoping that he's able to get that next signature.
If they open the door for 5 more days, that's not going to be a problem because he was really only gathering signatures. You know, you have to file a bunch of paperwork first before you can actually go start gathering signatures. So he kind of like just jumped in, first time political, candidate, and he's kind of jumped in there and threw down his money and, you know, gathered up his documents and started busily filing these documents that he needed to file and educating himself about the entire process of running for Congress, which is no small deal. It's a lot. There's a lot to it. And, and at that, at the first moment he could, he started gathering signatures. And as you know, he's a working man, and he's also a caretaker for a lovely elderly woman in Ojai and has a busy life before he even engaged on this adventure of, and he's, eminently qualified. The man's got an awful lot of knowledge. And so it's really great that he's jumped up to the plate, and it's really, I think it's been quite a ride for him thus far. And it's looking now as though he's going to get this extra 5 days to gather signatures comfortably because he's been at a dead run for several weeks now. Anyway, it's pretty exciting. I thought you guys would be interested to hear it. Maybe the listeners be interested to hear it, too. He's going to make a fabulous congressman.
Well,
right on. Well, it's good to hear some good news.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, you guys have a good night, okay?
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Arbor.
Yeah, you bet.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye. John, that's an interesting half hour.
Well, absolutely, and I'm sorry. I had just on my end just a little trouble catching everything she was getting at, but it seems like
things are opening up for a better candidate? Is this what I'm following here?
Well, what happened was the incumbent Republican withdrew from the race at the last possible second. And so it opened up the door for a Republican to run, for another Republican to run. But apparently, you know, so whoever is running now is not going to be fighting an incumbent. And it, you know, should be an interesting. We're going to keep an eye on that. We've been watching.
That usually. That'll open up the playing field for sure. I mean, when suddenly you lose the incumbency and in the whole thing, neither side will have the locomotion of having been in office. Anyway, it's 28 past the hour, Bruce. We gotta take a break and come back. John.
Yeah, this is Bruce Bertrand, and that's John Fox. This is Portland State Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Cup of Joe Report. I'm Joe Vecchio. The Republicans in Congress are considering a bill introduced by Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming that would exempt insurance companies from state laws that require them to include contraceptives in their prescription plans. Now, I don't know if this bill is going to become law, but it is the next logical step once you make abortions illegal, to make it as difficult as possible for people to prevent pregnancies to begin with. No abortions, no birth control, no sex education, no sex outside of marriage, no recreational sex at all. At least that's what they say publicly. Anyone who keeps an eye on the Republicans and their supporters know that they're famous for their hypocrisy. What they say in public is completely removed from what they do in private. And if you want to know what they're up to, listen to what they're accusing others of doing. It's pretty clear that this bill is aimed at the degenerate poor, the ones who either can't afford insurance or can't afford to get these prescriptions without the insurance they have. The rich and powerful will be able to buy all the birth control they want, and if that fails, they'll be able to get abortions whenever they like. No law, no religion, no ideology is going to stop them. And that's the only way any of this makes any sense at all, because it's obvious to this observer that the laws simply aren't meant for them. They can do anything they want because they have the money and power to get away with it. And they absolutely hate the idea of anyone else having those privileges. You see, it's not about the sanctity of life. It's about the sanctity of status. Now get back to work. This has been the Cup of Joe Report by Joe Vecchio. Listen to the Cup of Joe radio show, available via streaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com.
It's Grace.
We're actually very boring people, Rama. That's why we call ourselves homebodies.
Well, it's Rama.
Sure. I mean, you know, group sex for us is when we're both involved.
That's a
It's really, really smart.
We're a nice little Petri dish here in Vermont because you can experiment.
Join Grace and Rama, homebodies, every Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the web at homebodies.ramabahama.net.
Hi, this is Guy James. Remember me? As many of you know, I got the boot from the radio stations that carried my show a while back because I got a little too controversial for them to handle. Well, I'm back now, but I'll be doing my show 5 days a week from 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time starting on March 20th. You can join us at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org. And if you like hard-hitting, thought-provoking, entertaining radio, then join us starting March 20th at theguyjamesshow.com or whiterosesociety.org for the new Guy James Show.
Well, my baby, she don't want me around. She said she's tired of watching me fall down.
All right. You're listening to Bruce Birch and John Fox on Fourth Estate Radio. John, you still with me, buddy?
Of course I am, man. Just kind of rocking in with old David Lee there.
There you go, yeah. Yeah, we lost John a little bit there toward the last part of that segment, but good you're back with us. The telephone number, if you want to call into our radio program, you can call 1-877-443-2366 or if you like letters. That's 1-877, the number 4, head on. John, what do you got on our plate, buddy?
Well, oh, geez, you know, there's all this stuff going on, but, you know, like you said, third time through the news is when we finally get to really have a listen, and I'm just trying to have a look back here, but this,
you know,
while
you're doing that, I do have another clip I wanted to play.
And oh, please do, man. Oh, go for it.
This is the second clip of that Vernon Robinson feller. You want to hear this? I mean, this guy's whacked, and I hate to be giving him airtime, but he's so funny, you know, he adds a comedy element to the program. And I guess, Bob, if you play that second clip there, the one about, I think it's aliens or something?
The aliens are here, but they didn't come in a spaceship. They came across our unguarded Mexican border by the millions.
Illegally.
They filled our criminal courtrooms and invaded our schools. They sponge off the American taxpayer by clogging our welfare lines and our hospital emergency rooms. They've even taken over the DMV. These aliens commit heinous crimes against us, like Maximiliano Esparza, who raped a nun and strangled her with her own rosary.
Illegal.
They commit crimes, but won't commit to learn our language.
Illegal aliens.
You walk into a McDonald's restaurant to order a Big Mac and find, to your horror, that the employees don't speak English.
Illegals.
You may be in the heart of America, but you feel as though you are in the Twilight Zone. Vernon Robinson will secure our borders, cut off the welfare payments, and once and for all make English our official language. Press 1 for English? No. Vote Vernon Robinson for English.
I'm Vernon Robinson, and I approve this.
Gringo, ese episodio de Twilight Zone fue pagado por Robinson por Congreso.
Oh, my God! Will he cut off his own scrotum and eat it, too? That is sick.
Oh, hey, you know what? I'm thinking he's a xenophobe. What do you think?
I'm thinking he's a certifiable nut job.
And you know what? To top it all off, this guy's actually running against Brad Miller in my district this time. He doesn't even live in my district, and he's going to run against the guy who represents me in Congress right now, who is a Democrat. So, you know, I can't hardly wait. It's like I'm looking forward to this consistent comedy routine for the next, I don't know, 4 or 5 months.
Oh, that is just insane, man. So, like, would you do me a...
John? Hello, John. Okay, well, John seems to have left the program, and we'll get back up with him in just a second. Bob, you can let me know when John's back on the program. But, you know, that's just that clip of Vernon Robinson. Now, you can actually – the funny thing was this week that Vernon Robinson was actually up on Crooks and Liars, and as a result of some of that action of having his name out there, he – apparently pulled down the page on his election website that had all those ads on it. But let me just tell you, you gotta wake up early in the morning to get around the Bruce man. Because what I did was I went to the Internet Archive and entered the Wayback Machine. And when I did that... Did you like the echo, John? When I did that,
yes.
I stuck the URL to the radio page in there, and guess what came up? The page with all of the links. They took down the page, but they didn't pull the audio. So, I was able to download all
the audio.
So all
you had to do was even have it in your history, and there you were.
Yep, and so I was able to download all the audio, and there's a couple more, but I'll save those for another time, because they're just so hilarious. It just amazes me how, you know, how terrible this guy is. But,
well, you know, what I was saying before I got cut off was I hope that you can go and rig up a little mini PA system for your car and have these things edited properly on your MP3 player and just drive around your district with a microphone going, "This guy is a nut job. Don't vote for him." I think it's your public duty. That's insane.
It's actually, you know, it is insane. And the crazy thing is that, dig this, John. Last year, I'm sorry, 2004, those were running on the radio here. as real commercials.
I'm digging, man, but it ain't nice what I'm shoveling up. This is just... So, has he been running this kind of advertisement now, or has, you know, what's happening with him now? I mean, what have you actually heard from him today?
The filing deadline here just closed, I want to say, a couple of weeks ago at the very most. I think it was a couple of weeks ago on a Friday. So, as far as I know, you know, he hasn't done any campaign stuff yet.
Man, but it's just like Looney Tunes.
So I can hardly wait for the updated versions, you know. It'll be something about...
And
you
said before this is an African-American man?
Yeah. Yes. And actually, just to also add to the story, he's from Winston-Salem, which is about 20 miles to the west of Greensboro or so. And Winston-Salem is the big R.J. Reynolds tobacco town. Okay, that's where all the Winston and the Camels and all those, you know, all the cigarettes.
That explains a lot.
And it's a big Republican area. And actually, he was on the Winston-Salem City Council. And when he was on the Winston-Salem City Council, as a councilman, he demanded and had some city workers install a monument to the Ten Commandments on City Hall property.
What?
Yeah, just like that guy Roy Moore did down in, Alabama, I guess, Chief Justice Roy Moore, who was no longer the Chief Justice down there. You know, right about the same time, you know, and this was right around the election time, remember that, Vernon Robinson had this thing installed on the City Hall property there in Winston-Salem. It was this huge deal, man. He did it overnight. So when people came to work the next morning, here's this huge monument.
Oh my God!
On the grounds of the city hall, you know, and so it's like, where in the hell did this come from, you know?
So they had it built off site and like craned the thing in and just had it there in the morning. That's insane!
In the middle of the night, they hired a crane company to come install this thing in the middle of the night. So, and this was taxpayer dollars. So, yeah, taxpayer dollars. Dig that. So. You know, the next morning there was this big hubbub, and I think it actually sat there for about a week or so, but it was removed, and he ended up having to pay for the removal and, you know, out of his pocket pay for the installation as well. So, but it was just, you know,
at least there's that.
It was totally it was totally a publicity stunt. It wasn't, you know, it was all about, you know, I'm Vernon Robinson and I'm gonna kick some liberal butt is what I'm gonna do. You know, and this is a black man who probably, you know, if he doesn't have a Klan uniform in his closet, you know, this is the kind of guy who would go out and burn crosses, folks.
Well,
on
it sounds like he's one of these people that somehow miraculously grew up when and where they did and have seen never a slightest hint of racism's ugly head ever, like Condoleezza Rice. I mean, what a crock! What an absolute crock. Yeah, and Bob just asked the question, where does Vernon get his money from?
He gets his money from somewhere. There must be, you know, I would venture to guess it's past, you know, they passed ahead of the Klan meeting. But beyond that, I would assume it's, you know, perhaps the Ayn Randers or I don't know. Who knows? But
that's frightening.
It is frightening. But I just wanted to, And Benedict at Large brings this up. This is funny. He says this is a quote from Vernon's website, and he says that this election will be a referendum on Brad Miller's voting record. My candidacy offers the voters a mainstream alternative to a radical incumbent with too many kooky and extreme positions on the issue. I can't even read it with a straight face.
Man, I almost splattered all my bloody water all over my microphone there. It was the wrong time to drink water.
The fact that Vernon would say that his candidacy offers the voters a mainstream alternative.
Mainstream.
to a radical incumbent with too many kooky and extreme positions on the issues. I'm thinking Vernon would know kooky, right? He would know kooky and extreme.
Well, yeah, I guess suddenly, yeah, takes one to know one kind of a situation there. And I actually think, and I laughed because I started singing the Twilight played some music before the last clip played, but I mean, it's so appropriate. I mean, that's insane. Bruce,
it is. Yes, of course I'm still with you, John. I'm just, you know, I'm just contemplating.
Okay, sorry, man. I thought we got lost in the connection hell that it is. Bob's wanting to know if we want to run that audio again because that was.
Play it one more time, Bob. This is just too unbelievable.
There it goes. Are we there? I don't hear anything at the moment, but
I don't either.
These days can make you feel as though you're in the Twilight Zone. Americans are under attack from Islamic extremists in every corner of the world. Homosexuals are mocking holy matrimony, and the lesbians and feminists are attacking everything sacred. Liberal judges have completely rewritten the Constitution. You can burn the American flag and kill a million babies a year, but you can't post the Ten Commandments or say God in posts. 7 out of every 10 black children are born out of wedlock, and Jackson and Sharpton claim the answer is racial quotas. And the aliens are here, but they didn't come in a spaceship. They came across our unguarded Mexican border by the millions.
I'm Vernon Robinson. If you send me to Congress, I'll send that back to the Twilight Zone. I approve of this message and of traditional American values.
This... Nice one, Bob. Oh my God! Yes, the gays are attack. What was that? Mocking marriage, was it? And I was just thinking, yeah, only as a lighthearted joke in some drag show.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, come on.
That's Vernon. Good old Vernon. Good old Sheets Vernon.
Boy, Vernon's got a couple as short a chromosome or two. I think he's short a chromosome or two or something. I don't know. There's something seriously, seriously wrong with that man. But
he needs to go to... Go ahead, John.
Sorry, because I could just sit here and blither about this idiot for 8 Hello there. But anyway, I just wanted to go back to this thing that was in Bob's news, little news thing at the top of every hour about this Morales giving Rice a cocoa leaf inlay guitar. And I just think, well, yeah, Bush was probably really, really bummed that he was there, and he would have put him even more bummed when he realized that he couldn't do anything with the inlays. He's sitting there breaking out his, you know, his Visa gold card, going, "Come on, where is it? Where is it? Where is it?"
Yeah, you know, that's our president. Yeah, we have Sheets Robinson, and then on top of Sheets Robinson, we have Snorty Bush. Good old George
Sheets
the
Robinson. I like it.
Sheets Robinson and Snortalicious Bushy. Okay, looks like we got a phone call. Our friend Mary from Pittsburgh is on line one. Mary, how the hell are you, Mary?
Mary?
Is that John?
Yes, it is. Good day, Mary. How you doing?
Good evening, John. How are you?
Not bad. Bruce is here as well. Why do I have a feeling that you're ringing up about something about voter issues or machines or something?
Oh, I don't know. Why would you get that idea?
I don't know. It's what's usually on your mind every time you ring up.
Well, yeah, I guess probably because it's something that I think a lot of people are concerned about, and I was just talking to Agnes and telling her how I had about 4 hours of sleep last night before I had to work all day today, and thought that I needed to call in and real quickly let people know that here in Pittsburgh we're still fighting.
Good.
Yeah, and so what we're trying to do right now, I'll just jump to the end, is some counties have given up and they've ordered voting machines, but in Pennsylvania yesterday, we actually were granted a meeting with our county CEO because we stopped and thought, well, who gives money to these elected officials' campaigns? And figured out it's unions. So we contacted some union people we knew and we got a private meeting and sat down and said, hey guys, here are the facts, here's what you need to think about. And so What we're doing right now in Pennsylvania is we had a state rep at our meeting yesterday, and he seems to think the thing to do is to try and very quickly try and get elected officials and citizens trying to get attention to the situation and get the feds to give us sort of a stay of execution here and get them to give us until November to get everything and have a compliance.
Well, you know, when I said that you always call up with this subject of mine, it's we rely on you to keep us updated on what's going on the ground when it comes to these things. And I guess it looks like, you know, you're just looking for a stay of execution to fight to be able to use the paper ballot thing from what I'm getting, and you're making progress, which would be a
right,
good
well,
thing.
Right, and basically, just in shorthand, what people need to know is that there are two options for electronic voting machines right now. You can go with a DRE, which is a touch screen, or in our case, what they want to get in Allegheny County are used push-button machines from Las Vegas, Nevada, believe it or not. But they're basically DREs with no paper trail. The other option is an optical scan system, and even though the scanner's made by ES&S, which I have a lot of reservations about, it's still at least a state-certified paper record. So folks need to say, we want an optical scan. And the other thing they need to do in their states is, if they're being pressured, is to contact their authorities and say, look, states in the United States have been given extensions to comply with HAVA by November, and that may be a viable option at this point. So, and even if you do end up getting a really crappo machine in your district, like you said, John, it's still not over, because there's still going to be a need to work through some really strong voting legislation in your state once these machines start breaking down and problems start springing up.
Well, I tell you, there's something very, very just interesting saying that, you know, they're coming out of, like, you know, oh, the slot machine capital of the world, these voting machines. But
right,
it is a thing that we don't have the focus we need. Yeah, and I think we constantly get sidetracked when it comes to the voter issue, because, and where I have to give you credit on the way that you can stay focused on this to the point of just below obsession level, that when it comes down to it, if we want our voice heard at all, we need to fix this issue.
Well, exactly.
The people are saying, other than...
Right. I mean, I listen to radio shows and read the paper, and I just blow past all the dialogue, because until this issue is fixed, all the talk and all the best candidates and all the money that's going to go into the next elections may not amount to much unless we can get the best voting machines possible in our precincts. And the federal government is forcing us, the Department of Justice is forcing states to make a hasty decision because they drag their feet into buying these electronic voting machines. And I think it smacks of conspiracy, but I think it's because they want certain people to be elected in November. So citizens really have to get active, because if these machines are purchased, it's going to take a while to get rid of them. So in my mind, it all boils down to the voting machines right now, as much as I hate to keep harping on this.
I agree with you, Mary, and it sounds like you're absolutely buggered. So why don't you go and get some sleep, and we'll hear from you in the coming weeks, and you can tell us what's happening with this. And we do need to stay on this, so I really, really appreciate you always ringing up and keeping us with the eye on the ball in that respect. So thanks a lot for ringing, Mary.
Sure, no problem.
Right on. Good night. And so, Bruce... Hey, man, a lot of stuff in this show.
A lot of stuff.
It's been a full plate.
It's been incredibly long. It's been great. It's been fantastic. We even had a black guy who's a racist on the show.
Hey, we got Sheets. I'm really liking that, you know.
Mary made some great points.
I reckon you could still...
I'm sorry. I was going to say Mary made some great points, and I think that, you know, once the voting issue is resolved, we're definitely going to have to, you know, stay on top of that, because the bottom line is that the right never, you know, the right does not want us to vote. And that's just the bottom. Anything they can do to keep people away from the voting places, they will do. So,
And not only do they not want us to vote, they're continually taking control over the way in which we vote, and they also want to make sure that we do not see truly those nations that need to that are actually showing self-government. And this is where Central America and Latin America comes in. And next week we're going to have a really, really good friend of mine. Well, a new friend of mine, but Rodrigo Acuna, who has his doctorate in Central American history. And he's going to come on, and we're going to spend some time here live with him next week talking about what's going on down there. I mean, this guy won a full ticket to go and study you know, Central American history and politics under there. And I do believe he even met Mr. Chavez. So it could be very, very fascinating next week. So, yeah, man. And he's been, like, jumping to do the show. And he was quite crook there for a couple of weeks. And his throat was gone, so he couldn't do it. But I saw him at the lecture, and he would, like, practically jumped out of the seat going, "Hey, man." And I said, "Next week." He's going, "Perfect. We'll do it. We'll do it. We'll do it." And he's really excited to come on and tell us. I've got a copy of his thesis that I still have to read, and I will make that available on the site sometime this week so people can have a look at that. So what do you have on ATR tomorrow, man?
Well, on All Things tomorrow night, I'm going to have a wonderful person by the name of Liz Seymour. And Liz is the media spokesperson for the North Carolina Coalition for Peace and Justice. And the North Carolina Coalition for Peace and Justice is putting on... is putting on the March to End the War on Iraq on March 18th, which is going to be the three-year anniversary of the invasion and occupation of the nation of Iraq. This will be happening in Fayetteville at the gates of Fort Bragg. So it's going to be a pretty big event. Last year, I think they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000 people down there. So we're going to be talking to her about that and some other stuff that she's got going on. She was recently published in the New York Times for having a collective living arrangement in her home. And so it's kind of interesting. We'll talk to her about that. Also, we'll be taking your phone calls and doing some other things with the show tomorrow night. You know, what I normally do, try to, you know, create an atmosphere of peace and serenity while we, examine the idiocy. So...
And Grace and Rama will be warming the stream ahead of you tomorrow night, as usual, I guess. Well, isn't that the case?
Absolutely. Yes, they do. Grace and Rama.
Right on, man.
Have they come up with any mango recipes yet?
Ah, you read my mind, man. I'll have to ask Rama tomorrow whether they put any thought to my idea of that segment for them. You know, a weekly public service mango recipe. I think that would be good fun. But, you know, before our music comes and hits us, man, you know, Ben Birch streams and archives this show, never sends a bill, so stop by and help him on his fundraiser. And Cup of Joe's having a fundraiser as well, isn't he?
Indeed he is. Yeah, you can go to cupofjoe.blogspot.com for that. I'd like to, you know, just as a final thing, though, John, you know, I'd like to thank Bob Kincaid of Head On Radio Network for producing and announcing the show and for doing our news. White Rose for carrying our stream and archiving our program. And to all of our listeners, wherever you are, thank you for being a part of Fourth Estate Radio one more week.
Yeah, so coming up next, right after this, we have the entire Robert Fisk lecture. You definitely want to stick around for this, and it'll be available for download after the webcast. And I believe the music's starting to come in, Bruce. Thanks for a great show this week, man. It was fantastic.
Well, thank you, John. You did the all the good stuff. All I did
was
come along
for
the ride.
Hey, buddy, I wasn't expecting that bit of human rights and America history there. That was just an absolute pleasure. So we're gonna let the music take us out. I'll slide into the chat room in a little while, folks. Thanks for another great week.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us on Fourth Estate Radio.